You know why we celebrate Halloween?
Because that's when we go trick-or-treating and get candy.
Well, yes, but a long, long time ago, it was a night of great power. When the days grew short and the spirits of the dead returned to their homes to warm themselves by the fireside. All across the land, huge bonfires were lit. Oh, there was a marvelous celebration. People danced, and they played games, and they dressed up in costumes, hoping to ward off the evil spirits, especially the boogeyman.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.
In 1977, after viewing John Carpenter's film Assault on Precinct 13 at the Milan Film Festival, independent film producer Erwin Yablans and financier Mustafa Akkad sought out the 29-year-old writer-director to create a film for them about a psychotic killer that stalks babysitters. So with a mere $325,000 funded by Akkad, Carpenter and his future wife Deborah Hill began drafting a story originally titled The Babysitter Murders. At Yablans' suggestion, the setting for the movie was changed to take place over a single 24-hour period. October 31st, Halloween.
Saloon. My name is Andy, and with me, of course, is John Jansen.
Hello. Welcome, everybody.
That's right. Welcome to the Hollywood Saloon. Today, we're going to take on the legend, the saga, the nine-filmology, if you will.
The marathon.
The marathon. the endless saga, I guess, of the Halloween series, the story of Michael Myers. So here we go, jumping into this big, giant thing. And I got to tell you, you know, I was really excited when we decided to dive into this because I hadn't seen a lot of films. I had started, you know, from the beginning. I've seen the first one, obviously, and I think I worked my way up to five. And I remember that you and I saw that last one together, five. And then I went totally blank, off the radar with the Halloween films, and I had not seen one since. And so really, it was nice to say, okay, I want to dive back into this world and get in and get into this and see it. Even though, you know, are any of these films really good? I mean, that's the big question mark. Does anyone really care? I mean, nine films we're talking about here in the entire series. I mean, how many series other than maybe James Bond and a couple of different things here and there can say they have nine films? And especially one with such a simple concept of a mass murderer walking around, basically.
Yeah. The same plot over and over.
Exactly. It's really a testament to Mustafa Akkad, John Carpenter, everyone involved, that they've created the span of films over 30 years where people continue to go back and want to see this same story again and again and again. And it's been copied again and again and again. And that's the thing. I think, you know, we stand at a point now where what's very questionable is if this thing can ever continue on anymore. I'm sure they'll find a way and they'll probably make a way. But, you know, now standing, like I said, near that 30-year point, looking back to the beginning, we can see what started that, what influence occurred, and how this thing became a cultural phenomenon. I mean, most people know Michael Myers. Most people know the sound of the theme song. I mean, I would say probably one of the most recognizable theme songs in film history, in my opinion. Yeah, it's not Jaws. It's not, you know, it's not Star Wars or anything, but still.
Music seemed to be very effective for the film. It was very minimal, repetitious. Reminded me slightly of Dario Argento's score in Suspiria, to which this movie owes a lot. Reminds me also of the Tubular Bells in The Exorcist.
John Carpenter had the music in his head before he even directed the picture. As we were writing the screenplay, he would call me down to the piano and he would sit and he'd play this haunting tune. The idea of the evil character, which is Michael Myers, came from the idea of a man in a mask. And behind that mask, some horrific event was so frozen in the man's psyche that he had to recreate that for himself. And so the idea of that he was pure evil and that he only got even more evil as time went on.
It's a key element to the success and the atmosphere of that first picture.
Oh, absolutely. See, that's what I think. I think really you have this incredible atmosphere of this series. I mean, really starting in that first film, and a lot of it has to do with that music. I almost think that music is a character in that film. If you take that music away from this film, you lose probably 50% of the punch, the heart and the soul of the film. And it's really a testament to Carpenter that he's done that. And, you know, in all films, we're you know, Carpenter's making a little penny off every single film. Almost even like Monty Norman from the James Bond series, whenever you go back to another Halloween film, it doesn't matter how many years later and how removed John Carpenter is, you're always going to see theme by John Carpenter.
I bet he loves getting that check.
Oh, yeah, a little bit of cash for doing nothing, for writing a theme song, you know, 29 years ago or whatever.
Well, I think that's one of the key components of the early of the first film. And
sure,
there's certainly, it works on a couple of levels. And I think Dean Cundey is the next name you have to bring up.
Sure.
And the cinematography. The two elements that really I find striking about it is the anamorphic widescreen.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gives the film a sense of bigness. And maybe that was just coming out of the 70s type of filmmaking. But if you were shooting a low-budget movie, if you shot it in anamorphic, it suddenly looked bigger than it, you know, if you were just shooting it in 1:33, it looked like a TV movie, right?
Right.
John wanted to establish, as you watch this movie, we open very, very wide on these shots. And as you watch the film, John uses lens as we go on that are closer and closer and closer and closer to sort of build tension, to build suspense, but to also build a kind of feeling of claustrophobia. Here, wide, the shape is watching, but as the film progresses and the shape gets closer and closer to Laurie Strode, it becomes more intimate and scarier. And if you notice, the picture is shot in anamorphic lenses, which means it's widescreen. That's a John Carpenter thing. I mean, all of his pictures are anamorphic. And he really believes that it's bigger than life. It engages the viewer who's sitting in the audience into the movie by having that widescreen persona.
But then the sense of the panaglide and the way that, you know, Carpenter's camera was able to sort of float through the scenes. Not track on a dolly and not handheld. It had a very different sort of dreamy, floaty quality to it. That was just new in 1978.
The opening sequence is apparently a single Panaglide shot. Panaglide is a version of a gyroscopic camera known as the Steadicam. It's worn by an operator, and it gives a very special, unique visual look. This one long tracking shot was inspired by, of course, the tracking shot we all remember from Touch of Evil, the Orson Welles film. As I look at the movie, the primary influence on the style of the film was the work of Alfred Hitchcock. Hitchcock's moving camera would bring you, without a cut, from one environment to another, one room to another, one set to another. And I simply took my knowledge and appreciation for Hitchcock and took it one step further with the Panaglide, this camera that glides on its own. It doesn't appear to be a dolly, so it's not quite as stable. It's not handheld, so you don't always see the steps of the operator. because of kind of a weird sense of floating. But if anything, Halloween's style was driven by simplicity. The movie had to be simple in order to work.
You know, no cuts, none of the sort of the techniques that are used today. And what's funny is Halloween is sort of the textbook of horror film techniques. Everything from the jumping of the cat to the sting of the character, you know, bumping into a character. But you don't really see a lot of blood and a lot of really graphic gore. You could show Halloween on television today almost uncut.
Halloween's reputation as a violent horror film is only because what the audience thought it was going to happen, much more than what did happen. There is almost no on-screen overt violence in the film.
And I think that's the strength of the first film that's so amazing that you're talking about. All these strong elements taking place in one film in 1978, yet arcing all the way to 2007. One film so seminally strong, so powerful in its structure and in the way that it was, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is.
I was going to say simplicity, but and say that in a complete positive light. I think it's the simplicity of the first film that really makes it effective.
Sure. So, yeah, like I said, the power of that one film creating this whole entire genre, if you will. Now, think about that. Is this the film that defines the genre when it comes to what we call the slasher film, the slasher horror film?
Well, the horror film was around before Halloween, obviously. I mean, it's just, it's how it evolves. I mean, it goes in the 50s. I mean, you start with sci-fi movies and horror B movies, except then they were like giant bugs and creatures and them. And then, you know, it came from outer space. And then you have, I mean, these were the horrors for kids, you know, growing up in the 50s and early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But then the real horrors of the 60s and 70s came, like Vietnam and Manson and so forth. And then you get The Exorcist, which is taking the devil head on. Right. And then you get something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is taking, well, other real events and sort of, you know, setting them into a genre, if you will. I mean, Tobe Hooper is also, you know, certainly one of those early pioneers of grabbing a camera and making a really low-budget film that struck a chord in the 70s. There just wasn't a lot of these type of films made. And when they were really well made and well crafted above the, you know, I'm thinking exploitative, just B movie level.
Right.
I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was notorious in the 70s.
Right.
And I remember the first time I saw it, it was like, I really admired it because of just the ability to get it made and the fact that, you know, there's some really good camera work in that film. There's some effective editing and some good scenes and it works. But it was not nearly as graphic as I thought it was going to be, you know, as it had lived up to be. And, you know, I certainly think Halloween is also falls into that. But again, we move into the 80s to where suggestiveness a la Jaws, a la Alien, mm-hmm. a la Halloween wasn't enough anymore. Now we had sort of the Tom Savanis of the world and the Rob Bottins of the world and the Dick Smiths and the Rick Bakers.
Right.
I mean, just geniuses with prosthetics and fake blood and other kinds of things. So the gore was ramped up tremendously in the 80s. But in a fun way, it became like that was what you went to go see in these movies, to see what the latest gore effects were or what,
right.
You know. It's the Fangoria effect is what I call it.
Right, exactly.
Of just the art of special effects and trying to create a really scary effect you hadn't seen before. I mean, I think The Thing is just unmatched in that area.
Sure.
Since we can just don't on Carpenter in this episode anyway. I was going to say, reaching back into the, you know, going further, though, you know, you do something too long, trends get tired.
Right.
You know, the Friday the 13th series comes along, and they did, what, 7 films in 6 years?
Right.
Something like that. And it's the same techniques that Carpenter did in his film over and over and over again. Suddenly they're not scary anymore. Things turned. It's as if, and I think it had to do with Freddy Krueger and the Nightmare on Elm Street films, and with Jason at the same time, to where we were just now going to the films to watch the killer kill.
Right.
It wasn't like what the first one was, where we were going to see a situation about people that are in a you know, a nightmare, if you will, or a really bad night of their lives. It was now going about, well, let's see how Jason kills in this movie or what Freddy does in this one.
Right. So much so that you're cheering for Jason. You're cheering for Freddy.
The comedy's being ramped up, too.
Right.
And they're becoming, you know, far more, they're not taking themselves seriously anymore in that kind of way. The genre is changing and evolving as the numbers count up as well.
Right.
And then you have a lull to where they stop making them, and then you get a series like Scream that comes along and it kind of reinvents it for 5 minutes or,
right,
you know, 15 minutes or whatever. And the first Scream is a very clever screenplay. I mean, if you read that script, you think, oh, wow, this is great. I've seen all these movies that it's riffing on, and it's still got a really clever plot twist to it, so it works.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a whole new glut of horror movies again that we saw in the 90s, where the
scary movie
was ramped up all over again.
Right.
Well, I'm talking even before the scary movies. I'm talking about, like, you know, I Know What You Did Last Summer,
right,
and the urban legends. And suddenly, you know, there was a whole new swarm of horror films coming out.
Right.
Well, I think the idea of the horror thriller type picture has always been with us.
You know, sure.
It's certainly been a mainstay,
sure,
of that kind of thing. But they're very indicative of their times and of the audiences. And I think because of the proliferation of cable and video cassettes, we saw these films sometimes more than once.
Oh, absolutely.
We really got familiar with them, and we got familiar with the techniques. So it was a lot easier to get burnt out of these type of trends, because we had so much access to them.
Focusing on that time, the late 70s moving into the 80s, when you had the glut of, like I said, the slasher film, if you will, that's when you had these movies going up against each other. I mean, really, is there much difference between Jason Voorhees and Michael Myers? There's really not, you know? They both wear masks. One's a hockey mask. One's, you know, William Shatner mask. But, you know,
yeah.
I think that really it's the same film, like you said, going over and over again, and we get sick of this, and they battle each other. And what I've noticed as we watched these latest, all these Halloween films, is that really Halloween devolves and goes into that genre.
Because it had to follow the trends
it
of
has
what
to.
Else was going on out
right.
there.
Right.
Oh, and how can you resist it?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you want to break into the film industry, okay? All right, and you can cobble together $300,000 or $500,000, right? What kind of movie are you going to make? Well, I want to make a movie that people will go see, right?
Right.
That seems like a smart idea. So what will people go see? And you look at the trends, and it's like, well, Halloween was a hit. Great. Well, let's set it on Valentine's Day, and we can do the same movie.
Right.
Let's set it, you know, on graduation day, or, you know, pick your holiday.
Yeah.
You know, and so suddenly the holiday horrors, it was like, you better make your movie quick, or someone's going to steal your holiday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Silent Night, Deadly Night caused an outrage when it came out in the early 80s.
Wasn't there another one called...
remember that one, The Santa Claus Killer.
Yeah, wasn't there another one called Black Christmas by Bob Clark as well that was kind of set...
Oh, yeah, that was in the 70s. I guess that was sort of... had been forgotten, but, I mean, I guess this was the height of the 80s slasher.
Sure,
so
sure.
So people were really outraged that the killer wore a Santa Claus,
yeah,
outfit. And, you know, it spawned, of course, you know, at least 3 or 4 sequels.
Right.
As they all do.
Well, and that's the deal, is that you're seeing again and again over the timeline that we're talking about, the bringing up of these kind of outrageous serial killer murderers. You know, you have that one character, Michael Myers, Jason. What else is there? Candyman. You know, we could go on and on and on. Hellraiser, Pinhead, or
but
whatever.
You make the film cheap. You throw it
right
out there, and if it hits, look what you got. You have a goldmine franchise. I mean, Freddy Krueger built New Line.
Absolutely.
I mean, now New Line is known for Lord of the Rings, of course, but that's the house that Freddy Krueger built.
Right.
Obviously, Mustafa Akkad did very well off of Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
And the Friday the 13th were very profitable for Paramount. I mean, you know, they were making those things for $2 million.
Right.
And opening weekend was $6
million. Right.
I mean, just, that's pretty good even by today's standards. These Friday the 13th movies were grossing $33, $40 million,
mm-hmm,
which for a $2 million investment is outstanding.
Right, and we're seeing that now with Saw.
Oh, absolutely, you're seeing it. I think as long as there's an audience, you know, to... to go see these things, and you got to go see something. You know, everybody wants to see a good scary movie every now and then, right?
Absolutely. Well, now here's a big question.
The question is, what is scary now?
Right.
And that is what's evolving. And the boundaries are being pushed in that area, too. Mm-hmm. And I certainly remember my first screening of Halloween. Do you remember yours?
I don't remember my first screening. I believe it was probably on television every year in some form or another, either part one or part two or part three growing up. And I think that I know the feelings that it brought out in me, and that's why I consider it to be special and different. And that's the question that I was going to ask you as we look at how it affects us is, why do you think Halloween, why is that one that we want to talk about more than, say, in other ones? Why is this one special? Because I certainly believe that it's special, more so obviously the first film, but I think that there's a vibe that, you know, transcends and goes across all the entire series that, to me, makes it a step above some of the other ones, if you will. But I know that for me, being young, growing up and seeing the first film and the second film and whatnot, a lot of it mostly had to do with the music. I think I tied it in with the whole entire holiday of Halloween. When I watch the film today with my eyes today, I see what an incredible atmosphere that it creates for the holiday. And so really, for me, it's atmospheric, and Halloween, the film, the John Carpenter film, has kind of defined the vibe for the holiday of Halloween, because without that, I think it would have a different feel to it. And to me, if I'm going to sit down on Halloween and I really want to get that Halloween vibe, that feel, that's the film to put on more than any of them for me.
Well, I was too young to see it in theaters on its first run, mm-hmm. but I remember hearing about it and I wanted to see it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I had older brothers that had seen it, and it was like, you know, oh boy, that Halloween's the scariest movie ever, ever, ever. You know, and you hear that and it's like, ooh. And I guess, you know, the 70s still had an innocent feel to it, to where shows like In Search Of made you believe in Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and Boogeyman and, you know, wolves out in the woods and who knows what, you know. And if you're a kid, your mind is a little bit more open and gullible to things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, heck, I was scared to go swimming in pools after seeing Jaws. And you know pools are safe, but it was still scary in the deep end.
There's
you know?
A shark in the pool.
But in 75, you know, when you're, what, 6 or 7, that can have a big effect on you.
Absolutely.
But I saw Halloween on cable when it was on HBO. I think the first time it premiered, it was on Halloween night, of course. It might have been a year later.
Right.
In 79. And I was with Mortgage Man, funny enough. Two of us, all the lights off, and he had HBO, which was a big deal in 79.
Absolutely.
And we'd never seen a movie like it. So it completely, all of the skill that went into making it, it was like check, 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 check. Everything worked. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right.
You know, like when everything is clicking, we were just the perfect gullible audience to buy into every scare, every thought, you know, and the way the film drew you in.
Right.
It was terrifying.
One of the questions that I have been asked ever since 1978, over and over again, by every person, almost every interview that I've ever had, is what scares you? There seems to be a fascination with in a personal way, what scares John Carpenter? And my answer, I began by saying nothing, and then by saying loss of control or making up something. But I think what scares me scares every human on the planet. We're all aware of the forces of darkness, of evil, of loss, death. We know it as little children. I mean, I think all of this is dealt with in Grimm's fairy tales. I think it's dealt with in horror movies. Horror is a universal language.
I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
The film was Halloween, and it was 1978, the night that he came home.
Oh, man, I remember the poster.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's an iconic poster.
Oh, yes.
We talk about, you know, strong. I mean, it's such a simple graphic, too. That's what's so great about it, but it works.
And you remember it forever, absolutely. Written and produced by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. Executive producer Mustafa Akkad, Irwin Yablans. The DP was Dean Cundey, as we discussed earlier. And you know Dean Cundey. He went on to do The Fog, Escape from New York, The Thing, Jurassic Park, Roger Rabbit, Apollo 13. I mean, really, and getting his start here with John Carpenter at the beginning and... you know, an incredible cameraman that, you know, and it's obvious right there in the film.
Oh, he's in the Magician's Club of cinematographers. I mean, he's just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, you know, what's cool is he's working on just a shoestring budget. All these guys are like in their 20s making this movie.
Right.
These are just punk kids out of college.
Halloween was universally across the board panned by every reviewer who saw it. They said it wasn't frightening. They said it was stupid. They said it was too low budget. They said it was a dumb idea. Deborah Hill sent me a fistful of clippings that I read and got extremely depressed. Then, strangely enough, there was a review in the Village Voice that compared Halloween to Psycho and my work to Hitchcock. And all of a sudden, all the reviewers re-reviewed it, as if someone had just told them, you didn't see this movie correctly, why don't you look at it again? And to my shock, as the grosses began to climb, all the reviewers who had said it was so bad now were saying, this is great. Still to this day, I can't tell you, but I think that the audiences, as opposed to the critics, created Halloween.
Well, and that's the deal. They didn't know they were making a classic for all time here. John Carpenter and Deborah Hill got their $300,000 from Mustafa and said, we're going to make the best movie that we possibly can. And being that John Carpenter is who John Carpenter is, that's all he did. He went out there and made that film. Now, the cool thing is he was able to attract some great names. Donald Pleasance is a legend, okay? But what I remember him for most is Dr. Loomis.
I've been a fan of Donald Pleasance for many years. When he came to town, I had a lunch meeting with him, and he said, the only reason I'm here is because my daughter liked one of your movies, Assault on Precinct 13. And I don't understand this script at all. Would you please explain it to me?
And we at first offered the role to Christopher Lee, and he passed on it. Years later, I ran into him at an AVCO embassy function, and he came up to me and he said, I'm really sorry I didn't say yes to that movie, because it created Donald Pleasance a whole new career.
And I think that's true of a lot of people, and I'm sure that he never would have figured that this little puny budget slasher film would be something that would be his legacy. I mean, and he's passed away now, but they asked him, they said, so how many of these will you do? And he said, I'll quit around number 22. So he was in for the long haul, and that was amazing. He was Michael Myers' therapist, but really he's a manhunter, if you will. You know, almost like a bounty hunter trying to bring him down.
Well, he's Ahab going after his whale.
Exactly, exactly. Jamie Lee Curtis in her first film, I believe she was 19 years old.
The day after I finished this first day of work, I literally thought I would be fired. I got home, like any actor, was neurotic and crazy and thought I'd be fired. John Carpenter, that night, I was at home and I had a roommate, and she picked up the phone and said, Jamie, it's for you, it's John Carpenter. And I literally thought I was going to get that phone call of, Jamie, it just, I saw that, you know what, we're going to find somebody else. That's a normal actor's neuroses, is that they're, you know, it's a weird job we do. We put ourselves out there in a strange way. It was so much like guerrilla movie making. It was done on such a low budget. We were all sort of working for the common good. Everybody was very young. I think John and Deborah were the oldest people on the set. They were 30. So they were all these young grips and young electricians and young actors, and we were all working toward this common thing.
The world is introduced to Jamie Lee Curtis here, who, of course, will become a major, major star.
Probably doesn't hurt that she's the daughter of Janet Lee, who just happened to be the star of Psycho.
Absolutely. You know that had a lot to do with that casting.
Oh, heck yeah, it does. That's an article. That's a story. That's publicity for your film. I think it's important to note that, you know, where Carpenter was as a filmmaker.
Assault on Precinct 13.
I made a picture in 1976 called Assault on Precinct 13. My first real movie. By that I mean that I had to shoot it in so many days. And it was shot in Panavision. I'm very happy with the film for a little tiny movie that turned out all right.
I made a television movie with Lauren Hutton, and that was the movie that really got my chops going. I really got up to speed in terms of preparation and acting, working with actors. Then right afterwards, I made Halloween.
So by the time he had gotten to Halloween, he had a few films under his belt.
Right.
It wasn't like his first or second film. It was more like his, you know, fourth or fifth film in that kind of area. Right. And I think it certainly shows in the confidence he has in shooting so many really nice, elegant master shots. There's not a lot of coverage in Halloween.
Right.
Mostly because they couldn't afford coverage.
Right.
But it works so well into the style. And, you know, like you were saying, the atmosphere of the picture, you know, you have that nice wide frame and there's always something interesting to look at in terms of just the scenery and, you know, the way the framing and the blocking of the shots. It's all very creatively done. So that's why I think it's kind of fun to revisit, even though you kind of know everything that's going to happen. It's still so skillfully made, you can get wrapped right back up into it all over again.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you were saying earlier about Carpenter deciding to shoot in scope is that, you know, on a $300,000 budget, that cost him half of his budget, $150,000 to shoot in scope like that. So he's really taking a risk here to shoot this film like this that would ultimately, you know, help make it such a beautiful film. And I think, you know, that's something pretty dangerous that he put on the line there. But, it was something he was impassioned about and he wanted to do, and he's done on all his films, is to shoot him in that scope. And he, you know, and did he have the money for it? No, but he did it anyway. So really, what you're seeing on camera is more like a $150,000 film.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which is even more impressive when you really think about it.
It's so worth the investment because it gives it that bigger than big look.
Right.
And what's funny is I didn't see it in scope until it hit Laserdisc.
Right.
In the 90s. None of us did unless you saw it in the theater. Well, there you go. Even on pan and scanned, it was still scary. The heart of it still worked.
It was shot over 21 days in 1978, at the beginning of the year. Now, when Deborah Hill and Carpenter talk about when they were developing this thing, like we had said before, it was called The Babysitter Murders, and they decided to put it over a one-day period, mostly for budgetary reasons, because they didn't have a lot of money to make it look like it took place over a long period of time. And if you're going to put it in one day, and then with the great idea that Yablons had of just saying, well, what if we did it on Halloween? Well, you solve half your problem right there. Because you've got a spooky factor there that's going on. Now, obviously, Carpenter took that and played on that with. I mean, think about this. What's the perfect way they set that film than the opening credits, the slow pull in to the jack-o'-lantern?
Originally, I had written an opening of the movie where the camera was dollying down a street. You could see the leaves blowing and the sidewalk, and we would come upon a mask lying in a gutter. But some of it wasn't as stylistic as the slow track-in on the glowing pumpkin, lit inside by Dean Cundey with the flickering light and candles. Credits running on the right.
You know, with the theme song pumping, I mean, just that alone, the mood is 100% set.
And however Carpenter negotiated to make sure it said John Carpenter's over the title, absolutely worth it. You know, it cemented his name as well as the author of the film.
Well, part of the deal was that he only got 10 grand for this film, period. I mean, that's about all he made, which is one reason why he was involved with the sequels later on, because he was like, well, this movie made a lot of money, but I need to get paid now.
That I didn't see any of.
That's right. Mustafa took all that to the bank. So, yeah, that was the reason why you saw him do at least two sequels.
And saying a lot of money is really lowballing. It made a lot of money.
Its final dollar figure, U.S., was right around $50 million.
The movie back then was the largest grossing independent film in history. It cost $300,000 to make, and it grossed $55 million. John Carpenter and I didn't see a lot of that money. I mean, we saw very, very little of it because we were inexperienced and naive, and we didn't really have a solid contract.
Now, you got to remember that this is 1978 dollars, which is a whole different thing.
It's like Jaws proportionate in
a
lot of ways.
It is.
In terms of what you spent and what you got back.
Right. So it was absolutely incredible that a film of that kind of budget could bring in those kind of returns. I mean, it really was a cultural phenomenon.
I think in many ways it's like Easy Rider Part 2. The same principle applies.
Right.
It's a low-budget movie aimed at the youth market that the studios wouldn't make or understand. So you kind of make it outside of the radar. Right. And it gets out there, and word of mouth carries it, and it spawns imitators from, you know, from that point on.
Right.
You know, and you see that again and again. You know, it's a little fat girl moment. You know, we talk about that from time to time.
Absolutely.
But it's a huge one in that regard.
The movie was heavily criticized for some aspects of this idea that the other girls in the movie, since they had boyfriends, were somehow morally deserving of dying from the hands of the Shape. And Jamie Lee, because she was a virgin, was the heroine that I let live, which is absolutely untrue. The whole point of it being that the girls who were involved with their boyfriends were too busy to notice what was going on.
Critics, later on, watching the movie, tried to apply some sort of morality that we were, as filmmakers, trying to imply. And that was never true. The idea was that Laurie was naive, not that she was sexless, that she hadn't yet found herself, or the other two girls were bolder and had found themselves. And so, therefore, they pushed the envelope a little bit further than what Laurie did. Laurie was safe. She likes everything safe. She doesn't want to ask the boy out. She doesn't want to go to the dance. She's going to babysit. She's going to do the right thing. She doesn't want to get a first kiss. I mean, all this, she was looking for safe. And the irony is that it wasn't safe.
The idea that she's the one who, only one who can see the Shape, comes from the idea that because of her repression, perhaps her shyness, she has the instincts and the ability to watch. She's a watcher, just like the Shape is.
Now, when you think about Halloween, obviously the first thing that pops into your head is who? Michael Myers, or the Shape, as I like to call him. Now, an interesting thing, and a lot of people know this about the Shape and how he came to be, just on a physical aspect, was now you got to give a lot of credit to Tommy Lee Wallace, director who would go on and do Halloween 3 later on. He was really a protege of John Carpenter. Because of the low budget, wardrobe and props were often crafted from items on hand or that could be purchased inexpensively. Carpenter hired Tommy Lee Wallace as production designer, art director, location scout, and co-editor. Wallace created the trademark mask worn by Michael Myers throughout the film from a Captain Kirk mask purchased for $1.98. They went to Don Post originally, who worked on the mask in Part 2 and did the mask for Part 3, which was essential for Part 3. But they went to him, and he wanted, you know, a couple grand or whatever for the rights to do the mask. And they said, we can't afford it. And so they went with the $1.98 mask that Tommy Lee Wallace created. They offered Don Post a certain percentage, and he said, no, no thanks. I need my money up front. Well, of course, that was the worst decision that Don Post ever made, and he never turned them down again after that point. Don Post being someone who's very world-renowned for making masks and Halloween costumes.
And Shape masks, too, because he's got a few of those, too, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
Now.
Now.
Yeah. But where was he when they were making Halloween 4, 5, 6?
They needed him then.
God, those masks are bad.
But Carpenter recalled how Wallace widened the eye holes, spray-painted the flesh a bluish-white. In the script, it said Michael Myers' mask had the pale features of a human face, and it truly was spooky-looking. It didn't look anything like William Shatner after Tommy got through with it, Hill adds. And that the idea was to make him almost humorless, faceless, this sort of pale visage that could resemble a human or not. So, and that's an interesting thing when you think about the Michael Myers mask. It's really, it's just a human face. It's not like it's a monster or anything. He's not really a monster. It's just a...
It's a blank, emotionless face. It's
right.
Just, it's a nothingness.
Exactly, which makes it all that much more scary. Now, when you think about that also, you're going to need someone to walk around and do that. Now, here's an interesting thing. Now, we got Tommy Lee Wallace, who goes on to be a director as well. These are all people in Carpenter's camp. Now, here's another name that comes out at you, Nick Castle.
Nick Castle asked me how seriously to play the mental illness. And he has a certain stance and move that I think was never captured in the other films. The movies used actors or stuntmen that didn't quite have the grace of movement that I felt Nick did.
Now, Nick Castle will go on to be a director himself. He directed The Last Starfighter, The Boy That Could Fly, Dennis the Menace.
Tap.
Major Payne. All right. Mm-hmm. He did some amazing story episodes. So, being in the Carpenter camp and being around, Carpenter said, hey, you know, I like the way you walk. I think he said he noticed that he had a special walk. And so, he cast Nick Castle as the Shape. And so, for the majority of the film, I think with the exception of the shot where the mask is removed, Nick Castle is the shape. And to be honest with you, you know, seeing all the films now, I don't think it was ever matched as far as
it's really funny how that worked out with that, whether he realized it or not.
Right.
He would put something in cement that would not be duplicated.
Right.
And, you know, it is very unique. It has a fluidness to it in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, again, almost like the Pantaglide, it just has a movement that's all of its own. And you're right. I've now seen it. I've seen so many different people play the shape now, from stuntmen to just other actors. And
right.
Nick Castle understood what was necessary in a minimalist way.
To me, I always look at it. It's the scene we've already gone through with the poking of the eye, you know, in the closet. And he's down, and Jamie thinks he's dead. And you've got the foreground shot of Jamie sitting there kind of crying. This is before Loomis comes in. And we wait, we wait, we wait, we hold. And then the shape just sits up and then turns his head. Absolutely a horrifying moment, because it's one of those, look behind you, Laurie, look behind you. You know, that you know the audience is saying, and they're creating that anxiety. But his fluidness in doing that, almost robotic, if you will, I mean, just that alone to me was the pivotal point where I say, that guy's got it down. And I have never seen anyone else do it. You know, and you also see the deal where in all the other films, the other Michael Myers try to turn their head, like kind of like as a question mark, kind of as like an innocent child. And it's just like, okay, Nick Castle did it correctly, and you're just a bad impersonator of Nick Castle. I don't know how you teach someone else to do that. You've got to be a good director, you know?
Well, you know these guys go and they watch the movie, so they're trying.
Right.
At least they're making an attempt. It's just, it needs someone in there to really craft it and make it work.
It's important for the through continuity, but it's also important for the character. Even walking speed has something to do with it. I saw one of these Halloween movies, I forget which one it is, where I saw Michael, instead of just walking, move to a little bit of a trot. And I'm like, Michael Myers would never, ever run. Never. He's going to walk slow. You know, he's just a force that is coming down on you no matter what. He doesn't need to run. He's going to get there. And, that was, like, ridiculous. And I think that's part of the problem with these, when you see the future films, is that, number one, it doesn't carry over. And you can, it's like, okay, that's a different person altogether. And it doesn't feel the same. But also, it doesn't create the same creepiness. Now, that could also have a lot to do with John Carpenter and how he directed Nick Castle to do that.
I mean, how did you feel when you got to the ending and he looked over that balcony and he wasn't there?
Yeah, what a moment. And there you go. One of the things that we love about John Carpenter is his incredible endings that he has on his films, his unresolved endings, his you write the next scene aspect of the films. And, you know, with the music that started up right after that and then he was gone, it was like, man, that is so damn creepy. And, you know, you think about it in yourself, you know, there could be someone walking around my neighborhood like that.
Well, what better way to end it? Now all these teenagers are walking out of the theater into the night, and guess what? The killer of the movie is still out
there. It's still out there. So, I mean, and that's what I think. I think when you look at Halloween, the first film, it's a landmark film. Because it created these things that would be copied and copied again. It doesn't mean that it's bad. It just means that it set a standard, which made it strong. And it would influence, like we've said, many, many other films to go on. Now, one thing that we need to cover before we move to the next film is that there was multiple versions of Halloween.
Well, it actually plays into the next film.
Right.
Of why there is an extended cut or a television cut of Halloween is what you would want to call it.
Television rights to Halloween were sold to NBC in 1980 for $4 million. After a debate among John Carpenter, Deborah Hill, and NBC's standards and practices over censorship of certain scenes, Halloween appeared on television for the first time. To fill the two-hour time slot, Carpenter filmed 12 minutes of additional material that include Dr. Loomis at a hospital board review of Myers.
Michael Myers is the most dangerous patient I have ever observed.
Doctor, there is no diagnostic evidence to support that statement.
He's covering up. This catatonia is a conscious act. There's an instinctive force within him. He's waiting.
And Dr. Loomis talking to 6-year-old Michael at Smith Grove, telling him,
"You fooled them, haven't you, Mike? But not me."
Another extra scene features Dr. Loomis at Smith Grove's examining Michael's abandoned cell and seeing the word sister scratched into the door.
Those scenes were shot during the making of Halloween 2, apparently.
When you bring in the word sister, that changes everything.
Heck yeah, it changes everything.
Right.
It means George Lucas is suddenly going to get an idea. I blame Carpenter for the destruction of Star Wars.
But yeah, that's exactly what happened, is that, you know, he went back and changed the flow, because I think, you know, in the original release, it wasn't necessarily the intent that there was a sister element, that Laurie Strode was actually Michael Myers' sister.
Along came a sequel to Halloween. I wrote Halloween 2 and frankly discovered very quickly that there was no more story to this idea. I was completely stuck as a screenwriter. And I believe it was like 2 a.m. with a six-pack of beer in front of a typewriter. And what can I do? Oh, God, help me. I'll make him a brother.
Yet on this NBC extended cut, we enter that element, which obviously plays into the rest of the series, because then it becomes a whole story about why Michael has to kill his family. That right. One thing it does do is it gives him some sort of a motivation, because that's one big question we have throughout these. What is driving Michael? What is his motivation to kill? Why does he, you know, keep coming after these people? Well, to a certain extent, you can go back to this whole sister element and say, well, at the very least, he's got this thing for relatives. He's going to go to Lori, and then later on in 4, 5, and 6, he's going to go after Jamie, and et cetera, et cetera. So it gives you motivation, but at the same time, it kind of sets up this whole thing of, oh, you know.
Well, and that's the whole I don't know if bringing logic into these type of packages
right.
is necessarily your best weapon.
Right.
I think that's what makes the first film work so well, is there is no relation. There is no reason. Michael Myers went crazy. He went evil. Whatever happened as a child that made him pick up the knife and go mm-hmm. stab his sister,
right.
you know, happened. And it was inside him for so long, it was just bursting to get out again. And it was just trying to recreate that moment again that he had that night of taking the knife and killing on Halloween night. And it was just, at its simplicity, he became the boogeyman, and that was all you needed.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.
It was enough.
Right.
And I didn't, you know, I certainly, when I first saw the film, didn't need a relationship. I didn't need it explained to me, you know. They had me from the get-go. So everything else is just, it's just you start padding your movie. It's almost like shoe leather as dialogue and trying to over-explain something that just doesn't need it. It's
right.
far more scarier and mysterious what you don't know sometimes than when it's all spelled out for you,
mm-hmm.
As a lot of the later films, I think, fall victim to.
He's gone from here. The evil is gone.
What's going on out here?
Call the police. Tell the sheriff I shot him.
Who?
Tell him he's still on the loose.
Is this some kind of joke? I've been trick or treated to death tonight.
You don't know what death is.
Halloween 2, 1981, 3 years after Halloween has premiered. The tagline this time is "More of the night he
came
home."
More
of the night.
This is the Rocky 2 version. We are picking up from the moment.
The moment.
We're even going to rewind a little bit. I'll show you the very end again, a la Rocky.
A la Rocky, and I do like that. I like the way that worked out. But again, we're produced and we're written by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. Mustafa and company are on board to make their cash. Like you said before, really, this movie only exists for the cash. I mean, It's just the continuation. And was it necessary? Well, not really. I think, and it kind of...
It was necessary. Two Friday the 13th movies had come out and made buckets of cash. That should have been Halloween's money. It's like you're saying, hey, you're stealing our money.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, well, you ain't got no new film. You better get your sequel out. It's like, well, why don't we have a Halloween 2 out? And this is the interesting thing is like, okay, Halloween 2 is going to get made. What's the film do you make? And it's almost like you want to go back and whisper into Carpenter's ear. It's like, you know, go with your gut and just have it take place 3 years later.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, from a story point, I guess I can understand continuing that night is the simplest way to deal with it.
Right.
It's like, well, he's out there. The last shot says, you know, he was gone. So just pick it up and continue it on, you know, almost playing the film out in a 3 or 4 hour time period.
Yeah, but one of the biggest problems that we have with the film is keeping that continuity 3 years later. One of the first things we said, and of course Jamie Lee's back for this thing. Most people are back. Loomis is back. Everyone who had a strong role in there at least makes some sort of cameo appearance if they're still alive.
Right.
I think that's the hard part going into this film. And the thing that ultimately hurts it is that, yeah, you might be able to make a thrilling movie to a certain extent with the same idea, you know, and they at least tried to separate it from the first film by putting it in a hospital, by in one different location instead of in a series of houses around a neighborhood.
It opened up all kinds of other problems at the same time, too.
Right.
And as you said earlier, they just fell victim to all of the same cliches that all of the clones were doing.
Right,
in
exactly.
All of their slasher movies. And, you know, it just... Michael Myers became just another one of those, unfortunately, in that film. And Jamie Lee's wig is horrible.
I know. That's really the killer for me, almost of the whole film, is that her wig is so awful. She looks so different that there is just no way, from a continuity standpoint, that this can be the same night as Halloween.
I applaud Jamie Lee. What an easy gig she had. Would she have maybe about 6 lines of dialogue to learn?
Yeah, and exactly.
You know, just lay around the hospital bed, a couple of chase scenes, and you're out. But
right.
No, I mean, wasn't there an abandoned concept in like a high-rise apartment building or something that was going to be Halloween 2?
Right. Well, that's what there was a few different ways that they were looking at it. That was one of the ones where they wanted to put it 3 years later. And Laurie was living in a high-rise, you know, complex, and Michael comes into the high-rise. Now, they kept the same basic idea. They just moved it into a hospital.
A hospital, right.
But it happened on the same night.
I mean, basically, it's a replay. I mean, it's Laurie dealing with, 3 years later, her own psychosis.
Right.
You know, and they had an inch of James Cameron's brilliance of the 80s, they could have turned Halloween 2 into Aliens. It could have been all about Laurie Strode stepping up against the shape 3 years later in this apartment high rise.
Right.
I mean, we would wait, you know, till age 20 to get that kind of idea back in.
Right.
But they weren't brave enough to think that way. It takes an Aliens or a T2 to get other people to imitate it and put it into their movies.
Right.
So I understand. I mean, you got to make the sequel. You got to get it out. So you pick it up from the night. You try and bring back as much of the other cast as you can. But unfortunately, it opened up all kinds of other problems. The stupid factor is just on really big in this movie, to where you watch the first movie and you don't really ask that many questions about, oh, what was that about, or why, or anything. You kind of go with the flow. But Halloween 2, I'm suddenly asking myself, all right. And let's just say I watched the extended version and I know about the sister subplot, okay?
Yeah.
What's Michael's purpose in Halloween 2? Is it, okay, he's already had a night of some killing and he missed his target now.
Yeah.
So it's about getting the target, right?
Right.
Obviously. So what's everybody else? What's that girl in the house? It's like we need a kill, you know, at 12 minutes into the movie. So we just got to kill her. Because there's no kill. Otherwise, there's no kills for like 40 minutes into the movie is the next kill.
Well, obviously they wanted to open up the film with the homage to the original Michael walking POV shot.
The Pantaglide shot.
Exactly.
You're right. Yeah, they had the big long shot.
So we have the big long shot around the neighborhood. We see Loomis running out saying,
I shot him six times. He's not human.
So they're trying to do the homage, but they're thinking, you know, we got to get a death in here. We're into this movie. We got to get things rolling because Michael's on a roll. So they do that death, and it's really, it has no point whatsoever.
Well, it's the rules. It's now the rules of the genre.
Right.
You don't make Halloween 2 and make people wait 40 minutes for a kill.
Right.
It defies the logic of the first movie that had a kill in its opening 8 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to get a kill in there, whether it made logic sense or not. And the moment the film decides to do that, it means it's going to do it again and again and again. And you see it all over the place. And really, Halloween 2 is very different. It's kind of Michael on the prowl a lot.
Right.
You know, walking down the street. Wherever he needs to be, he's there. Who cares that he walks so slow, but he can get all the way across town to the hospital and everywhere else he needs to be in remarkable time. I mean, this guy's fast. He's just hiding it.
Well, and one of the things that to me caught me off guard with watching too is, now again, we have a different director here. Carpenter didn't come in. He wanted Tommy Lee Wallace to do it. Tommy Lee Wallace passed on it. And then we got Rick Rosenthal coming in, who we will see later on in the series as well. But like I said, most of your people are back for the film. But the thing that's so crazy with me is that, okay, Michael was a certain way in the first film, but in the second one, all of a sudden, he's smart. He's got smart, interesting ways to kill people. He's like thinking about, how can I kill people in an interesting way? Well, I'm going to do a scalpel, and then there's this one person, I'm going to take that black nurse and give her an IV and let her blood drip to death. I'm going to hit some people in the head with some syringes, Dr. Mixter and a nurse and whatnot. And it's kind of like, okay, we understand there has to be the pickoff. Okay, and then Michael's modus operandi is to kill everyone around the target before it gets to the target.
This is what movies, 80s horror movies, were doing, though. It was, how do you top the last kill you saw?
Right.
It's the equivalent of stunts. It's the equivalent today of gross-out gags. But, I mean, how do you do it differently?
Right.
You can't just have Michael kill with a butcher knife again, can you? That's going to get boring after a while. So they got to give him, like, you know, syringes and drowning people in hot tubs that go to boiling, scalding
Look,
hot.
All right, I got to say something about that. That cracks me up the most. Well, number one, we have, what's her name? Pamela Susan Shoup, who's playing this nurse. And she's hot. All the chicks are hot. It has to be that way. I mean, this movie could have been, you know, hot nurses get killed. You know, and that's really what it's about. It's the slow pickoff of them.
It's horror hospital for sure.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we get the little scene where they leave all the babies, okay? Forget, there's no parents in the hospital. They've all gone home to trick or treat. They've left their babies overnight.
And forget the fact that Laurie Strode was just being hunted down by a killer who we now know as a brother. But let's don't bring any cops to the hospital to look after
her. To protect her, right.
Let's just keep all the lights off and just hope everyone gets some sleep.
Well, see, and what cracks me up about the hospital is so damn dark. You would think that someone said, all right, look, we're saving money, people. Don't you dare turn on a light. We've got a couple of lights here and there. But, you know, when you hear a noise and you go investigate, which is always what happens, there's a creak or a little sound. Michael's always hitting shit when he's walking around slow, obviously, because people hear these little sounds and they have to investigate. You know, no matter what it is, no matter if you know the killer's in the hospital, ooh, I got to go find out what that sound is. So they go to investigate because Michael hit something again. And what would be your first inclination? Turn on the damn light. And no one ever does that. They just they walk into the dark room. They don't hit the light. Hello. And that's what's silly about this movie is that you have characters that if they just use their common sense, the movie would be solved because they turn on all the damn lights. And,
well, you would have no movie. I mean, you've got to have characters like that stupid cop.
Stupid characters. Well, that's the... You have six dumb people running this hospital, basically.
I remember some scene where he's like, you know, he's checking closets and, like, he opens up one. Why? So boxes can fall all over him, you know? What, did the shape set that trap up or something, you know?
Well, it's like...
I mean, all these little obstacles?
Well, remember, that's the deputy, the one guy that they have who says, when the phones are down, I'm going to go check the phone lines. Here's a rumble in the dumpster.
So he goes, it's a cat joke. The cat dad.
The stings. You know, the stings, they get worse and worse and worse as the films go along because they're just cheap gags that you could just throw in. And that got bad. Now, one thing that drove me crazy about this movie, and this is a silly little point. Now, like I said, when I think of Halloween 2, I always think of Death by Hot Tub. Always. We did get some boobs. We got some nudity here. You know, we had not gotten that before, and that was something, that was a strong positive when we were kids for Halloween 2. It's like, yeah, get to the hot tub scene. I want to see those boobs again.
Right.
You know, so we have the hot tub, and it's always about, oh, it's getting hot in here. Can you go turn it down?
I'm not kidding. It's too hot in here now, but why don't you go check?
It's cold out there.
It can get cold in here.
So, and of course, Michael Myers is turning up the heat. This is the same guy who basically should be ripping people's heads off. Oh, and he's doing these little fine-tuning things. Michael Myers is going to think, ooh, I'm going to turn this water up and make it uncomfortable for him. So we see Michael turning it up. Of course, on the little gauge, when he's turning it up, there's a setting for scalding. This is a hot tub for human beings. They're not cooking potatoes in there. They're not boiling, chickens or something. This is for human beings. Why is there a setting called scalding? You know, I don't care if it's for therapy. It shouldn't have a scalding setting. I mean, it's the whole thing, you know, well, these goes to 11, you know? Well, no, this hot tub goes to scalding, you know, for that one person who really likes it hot, wants to melt their flesh off. So, of course, Michael turns it up to scalding, slams the face in there, and she dies. And I don't know, did she die from drowning or did she die from, you know, her face being melted off from the scalding setting?
Oh, it was the scalding, I'm sure. Otherwise, why have it?
So, I mean, that was so silly to me.
He could have just drowned her anyway, right?
Yeah, he could have just drowned her, but no, I want to melt her face off.
Well, and also the idiot plot sort of kicks in real early on where you have Loomis and the cop and there's a Michael Myers figure walking. And suddenly, I mean out of nowhere, going 180 miles an hour is a cop car. That just slams into him, throws him against that van. Kaboom! You got a fire, and he's burnt to a crisp.
Right.
Only just so everyone can not know, hey, is Michael alive? Is he not? I don't know. You know, right. So they won't go look.
What the hell was wrong with that cop? I mean, this is a small neighborhood street,
There's kids out there trick-or-treating. He knows this.
It's like, oh, God, you know, I need to go 50 miles an hour down this little street. Oh, that was so ridiculous. And I think that's the thing that plagues this movie, is that you get these moments. They're going for their kills. They're going over the top to try to, you know, make their gore and make their point. And really, it's silly. We don't care about any of these characters. Really, honestly, you know, the stupidity makes you want them to die.
Well, and that was just idiot plot to keep the cops busy. And they tried to write it off by saying, ooh, it was Ben Tramer. You know, the guy that Laurie expressed an interest in the first movie. So it all ties in.
Right.
But okay, whatever.
Yeah. And I also love the point where there's people who decide to come out and throw rocks at the Myers house.
Oh, I know. Isn't it so great they can come out at midnight, you know, 11 o'clock at night?
Yeah.
Honey, come on. Let's go down to the Myers house. We're going to trash that sucker.
I hope it makes you feel good to trash the house, but you just look like a jackass doing it.
I mean, it's almost like I almost expected them to break out like signs, Michael Myers, go home or something, you know?
So, I mean, I think really what you're seeing is a big delay. You're just seeing trivialities until we get to the point where the movie actually starts for me. And I marked it. I think it's like an hour and 10 in where the main event begins again. And it's Michael versus Laurie. He finally gets to Laurie.
Yeah, when that nurse gets lifted by the scalpel.
Right.
When she drops, you get the theme.
Right.
Didn't.
Exactly.
You know, and it feels like, okay, here we go.
Here we go, finally.
And then it's just the chase movie begins, you know.
An hour in, the movie begins, like you said. Once you get that point, I mean, I'm pretty satisfied with the rest of the ending.
I'm not. It gets stupid. Oh, and don't you love, you know, 1:14 into the movie? The secret file. What file?
I know.
That Strode girl.
Oh, God.
That Strode girl.
And then we get to the very end, and of course, you know, Laurie and Loomis get him in there, and then we decide, boom, we're going to blow him up.
Oh, well, hold on. That whole sequence, though, is really underwhelming, if you think about it. Yeah. When they lure him in there and Laurie shoots him in the eyes.
Right.
Just that those big wide shots of him just barely, you know, just trying to attack.
Swinging that knife.
Like,
yeah.
Come on, Rosenthal. Get in there. Give me a POV. Give me a medium shot. Give me something.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It didn't really do much for me. It's not scary. I think that's a big problem with this movie is it's not really all that frightening.
Let me read you something about what you're saying is that it's not scary. Check this out. Believing Rick Rosenthal's version of the film was too tame, John Carpenter shot a few gory scenes that were added into the film despite Rosenthal's objections. Carpenter, concerned that the picture would be deemed too tame by the slasher audience, refilmed several death scenes with more gore. When asked about his role in the directing process, Carpenter told an interviewer, "That's a long, long story. That was a project I got involved in as a result of several different kinds of pressure. I had no influence over the direction of the film. I had an influence in the post-production. I saw a rough cut of Halloween 2, and it wasn't scary. It was about as scary as Quincy. So we had to do some post-production work to bring it at least up to par with the competition." So there you go.
And you can see it, certainly. That's where you get IV scenes and things like that, you know, IV drips. And then there's like alternate versions, too, because like in some versions, Last Starfighter dies and other versions he lives.
Right. Yeah. No, that was something that happened as well, is that the alternate version, which was more along with what Rosenthal wanted, was less gore, I think. And the fact that Last Starfighter does live, and in the end they hold hands and Laurie says, we made it, and you can see it on YouTube. I'll put a link up to it, but really it gives hope for some reason, and I don't really know why it matters one way or another, you know what I mean? So I did like the inclusion of Sandman at the very end of the film with the song. I thought it was very fitting. And whenever I hear that song now, I always think of Halloween.
Well, they were definitely looking to close the curtain on this thing because there's no Carpenter tag. There's nothing.
Well, and they closed it off very well. I mean, Michael burned to death, obviously. I mean, we see the mask burning and burning and burning and burning.
Yeah, it's a great stunt.
And we got Loomis.
And Loomis.
We figure he's burned to death too, right?
Well, didn't he get like blown away to the side or something? So he can come back?
Well, and the funny thing is that they just kind of have like some light third degree burns, you know, when we see him later on. Their hands are a little burned. That's what's funny is that they had to have a makeup department for the Halloween movies all for the rest of the films because they had to show that they were burned all because of the end of Halloween 2.
Except for when they got to number 6, where it's like, oh, I had skin grafting done because I don't want to sit in that makeup chair anymore.
Convenient. Exactly. Well, and there was even a few movies. I think in 2 movies, Loomis likes to show everybody his hand. He goes, look at my burn. I don't want anyone to live through that.
Well, there's no way, according to what we see in Halloween 2, anyone could live through that.
No.
Loomis is gone. It is. Michael's gone. And yeah, it closes the curtain. Because I think what they're thinking was is what was about to happen next. They're thinking, okay, they want Halloween 2. We don't want this thing to keep going on and on and on. Let's finish off the night. Let's kill off Michael Myers and that'll be it.
Right.
And then next year, let's do a whole different Halloween type movie. And let's keep the brand going and we'll just tell a different story.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Bum, 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 bum.
Make him the cutest that I've ever seen.
Bum, 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 bum.
Give him 2 lips like roses and clover.
Bum, 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 bum.
Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone.
I am talking about the real possibility that he is still out there.
Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock. Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock.
It's almost
time, kids. The clock is ticking. Be in front of your TV sets for the horror-a-thon. And remember the big giveaway at 9. Don't miss it. And don't forget to wear your masks. The clock is ticking. It's almost time.
Happy after Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy after Halloween, Silver Shamrock. Happy after Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy after Halloween, Silver Shamrock.
One year later, the film is Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
They were already probably thinking about this.
Absolutely.
When they were doing it, Tommy Lee Wallace was going to get his shot. And now, wasn't this an original story by somebody else that they bought, and then Tommy Lee Wallace got a writer-director credit?
Well, the original story was written by a guy named Nigel Neal, who had written some for a TV show called The Quartermass. It was a British TV show that John Carpenter was very much a fan of. And so he brought in Nigel Neal to help develop this Halloween 3 Season of the Witch story. When it was all said and done, he did not like the violence in the film, and he sued them to take his name off of it. So really, yes, we had an outside writer help develop the story, but ultimately Tommy Lee Wallace got in there and helped grafted it himself. And, you know, obviously Carpenter had something to do with it, too. This is kind of my special Halloween film, Halloween 3. My guilty pleasure, if you will.
Halloween cubed?
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, I think it has a lot to do with nostalgia. I saw it a lot of times as a kid. I thought the score was fantastic. But it's interesting to me because I really think they were brave in what they were doing. Now, let me read this here. It says, the direction that Carpenter and Hill wanted to take the Halloween series, stating, it's our intention to create an anthology out of the series, sort of along the lines of Night Gallery or The Twilight Zone, only on a much larger scale. Each year, a new film will be released that focused on an aspect of the Halloween season. See, to me, that's very interesting. And it's something we've talked a little bit about. I remember you talked about it when we talked about superhero shows like Smallville or something. Why not have a DC Hour, you know, where we do different stories? And to me, whether or not you like Halloween 3 or not, I think the attempt to create an anthology series is immensely more interesting than continuing this Michael Myers story that's just so tired of, you know, the pick-off chase slasher stuff.
Yeah, I think the big mistake is calling it 3.
Right, exactly.
It should have just been Halloween Season of the Witch. If you didn't know any better, and you got to remember, there's no internet. There's really no... You might just go up to the movie theaters that Friday night. Oh, wow, Halloween 3?
Right.
I loved Halloween. Let's go see it. And you keep waiting for the Shape to show up, and he doesn't. You probably either walk out of the movie, or if you watch the whole thing, it's really not the movie you wanted to see.
Right.
You feel like you got gypped.
Right.
You feel like the filmmakers, they tried to pull one over on you by giving you this really dark, ugly, mean, horrifying story that takes place on Halloween that doesn't have anything to do with Halloween 1 and 2. So I always felt like that was sort of a big weight around the film. That had that been removed, had it just been even Season of the Witch and allowed to stand on its own, audiences might have had, in the original run, might have had a better acceptance of it.
Right.
In that sense. But drop the 3, call it Halloween, and that way the next year you do Halloween and you just do whatever the next story is. And I think that would have been a great idea. You could do Halloween, Saw, or, you know, Halloween, Scream, or whatever. You know, it'd just be the branding, if you will. And isn't branding grand? Don't we love branding?
Well, that's ultimately why they put the title on there anyways, instead of just Season of the Witch. And, I mean, I think that they were tongue-in-cheek with it, and they played with it. Like, you know, there was two examples where we see our main character watching Halloween.
The Immortal Classic, followed by the big giveaway at 9, brought to you by...
Come on.
What's the matter? Don't you have any Halloween spirit?
No.
And so they play with it. You get to hear the Carpenter music. And I think that would have been a very interesting thread if they would have continued that out, is every film shows somebody watching Halloween or somehow Michael Myers ties in through it, but never again back to the shape and the hunting down and the killing. So you really have to separate yourself from the Michael Myers story and just look at it. Okay, here's a film, The Season of the Witch. I'm going to watch it for what it is. And I'm not saying it's a great masterpiece, but at least I'm saying it was an attempt to do something different. And personally, I enjoyed the film because I think it's kind of an interesting story. You know, we had laughed when we talked about it when we both watched it recently, saying that this is kind of like a megalomaniac James Bond movie with your wild, crazy man who wants to take over the world and cause all this crazy shit to happen. And you have your character, your James Bond. Of course, it's Dan Chalice here, Tom Atkins, Mr. Stud, instead. And so from that perspective, and the fact that it's like a takeover the world type of a situation, it's like an apocalypse film. It has scope to it. It's worldwide.
Well, and in other ways, too, it lines itself kind of nicely to the feel of the Halloween movies.
Right.
Because it does have that anamorphic widescreen look.
Sure.
Like the other ones did.
Dean Cundey's back again.
The Carpenter score is really good.
Yes, absolutely.
It oozes atmosphere. And do you notice the way they do the credits? October.
Right.
Saturday the 23rd.
We're building up to Halloween.
Really feels like the first Halloween in that way, and the way they would do things like that.
Right.
You get the Carpenter stings, which are always nice. There's so many in this movie, too. There's more stings in this one than all of them.
And they're always building up to that moment of Halloween. It's all about the celebration of Halloween. And I think that's, again, back to number one, is that we're talking about environment, we're talking about atmosphere, we're talking about the holiday itself, not only about this Michael Myers character. And I like that. And they kept reminding you, remember, it was the countdown. Happy, happy Halloween.
Turn that down.
8 more days till Halloween. 5 more days till Halloween. I mean, how many times did they play that commercial over and over? And it was funny because every time you'd see Dan here, he'd go, oh, God, turn that damn commercial off.
I don't believe this commercial never stops.
You know, he's always bitching about it. And they kept pounding it and kept pounding it. But to me, it's like saying, okay, we're building up, we're building up, we're building up to this one final huge climactic event that's going to change the world. And
how about those suit guys? You know, those guys are kind of creepy in their own way. You know, after the one commits that murder, runs out of that hotel and douses himself and boom.
Well, aren't they really kind of the shape themselves, just without the mask?
Exactly.
And it's really gruesome, those guys. Remember when they take that guy and they just basically pull his head off of his shoulders?
I mean, yeah.
It's like, wow.
Rip his head clean off.
I know. And it's like, oh, my God. I mean, it's almost possibly one of the most graphic and gory films of the entire series. You know, just because it's so powerful.
And then it's counterbalanced right after it by one of the cheesiest softcore love scenes you're likely to see. The laying down on the back of the bed.
Oh. Well, that's where the film went sour, is about 45 minutes in, you start saying, okay, are we going to hang around this little love shack hotel for a while?
This mystery plot, this, you know, Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, we'll solve it together. It's always, I'm going to have to go find out what happened to my dad.
Exactly. But she's not so distraught that she can't get a little piece of action at the same time. I mean, that cheesy scene. And that's what we were laughing about. I mean, this is Tom Atkins, okay? Remember Michael Hunsicker from Lethal Weapon? This is, you know, Hauk's buddy from Escape from New York. He's 47 years old. I checked when they shot the film. And Ellie, the girl, was 23.
Maybe I had to get another room.
That would look sort of suspicious, wouldn't it?
What I mean is, if you'd feel more comfortable, I could sleep in the car. Be better in this floor anyway.
Where do you want to sleep, Dr. Chalice?
Where do you want to sleep?
That's a dumb question, Miss Grimbridge.
Oh, it's so bad. You know, go over and get him some action. I mean, they ought to have porn music. Gow, 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 gow. And it totally separates you from the rest of the movie. And it kind of felt like they were stretching.
Well, see, I always felt like this was a good idea for an hour-long Twilight Zone show.
Right.
You know, stretching it out to 90 minutes feature length. They need to reconceptualize. They just focused on the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a global aspect to it that could have been expanded.
that might have been very interesting. I do like the scene that when, you know, the trick-or-treaters, you see them from all over the world,
right,
or the country and whatnot.
Yeah.
And the film, for a moment, feels bigger than it is.
That's what I'm saying.
And I do like the story. I mean, it's got a very creepy story.
Right.
And it's very mean-spirited, mm-hmm, and very scary in that way. Just in a conceptual idea, because it seems really plausible when you consider, you know, subliminal imagery and just, you know, a little circuitry trip that... You know, he gets hokey with the power of, you know, Stonehenge, and, you know, they even want to start dropping, you know, druids and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. But, you know, okay, whatever. You know, again, it goes back into that James Bond. It's bigger,
right,
than big. It's the
right.
big warehouse,
right.
You know, and, you know, there's some really nice shots in there.
Oh,
some
yeah.
nice, really good camera work, uh-huh. big covered shots, and... You know, I think for a little low-budget movie, it's got a good look to it. You know, I think Tom and the Oars did what he could with it. I think the effects are a standout and really, really creepy stuff.
Right.
And because it's with children, makes it really more shocking, because you just don't see that today. It's almost like there's codes and you can't do that with children.
When the mask is going on and you see the crickets and the snakes pouring out of his head and stuff, that's almost unwatchable. I mean, I could probably imagine that people ran out of the theater when they saw that. I mean, that was tantamount to the chest burster in Alien almost. You know what I mean? I mean, it was really shocking. And even seeing it today, it's really shocking. It's just like, oh, that was my kid? Oh, I'd burn that place down to the ground. I mean, it's horrifying. Well, but you really had an evil character in Connell Cochran. I mean, Dan O'Hurley, you remember him? He was the old man in RoboCop, you know, the old man. And,
right.
And also... And a lot of people don't know this. He was the guy who hung out with the last Starfighter and with all that crazy makeup. So
you're right.
That's kind of fun if you think about that, because no one ever remembers what he looked like. But I thought he was great. You know, when you get to the part where he finally tells Dan the story, when he's put him in that chair and he's about to put the mask on him and so he can watch
He's monologuing.
He's monologuing, exactly. But that's when it gets mean, and he talks about how the children have stolen Halloween.
You don't really know much about Halloween. You thought no further than the strange custom of having your children wear masks and go out begging for candy. The festival of Samhain. The last great one took place 3,000 years ago, and the hills ran red with the blood of animals and children. Sacrifices. Part of our world. Our craft.
Witchcraft.
To us, it was a way of controlling our environment. It's not so different now. It's time again.
And it's really about witchcraft, and it gets dark at that moment. I mean, that's, you see the hatred, and I think he played it well. He's not a stupid Bond bad guy.
No, and he doesn't play it sinister either.
Right.
Like, or like twisting the mustache. You know, it's very matter-of-factly, which makes it kind of scary, actually.
Right.
The fact that it is so matter-of-factly.
Well, in the end, I really love the part where, you know, of course, Dan breaks out and he pours the little electronic doodads all over him. And remember, he looks up at him and he gives him that little clap of, hey, you did it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that's just a great moment, you know. And
and I'm so glad when he dumped all those chips, they just so happened to perfectly line up with the lasers to kill all of the robots on duty. Perfect hits. I've never seen that kind of accuracy.
Did you see him sneak in there and turn the video on? He knew what buttons to press.
And exactly. That was so fun.
And nobody saw him. It's like, come on. Your robots are stupid. They're like stormtroopers. I don't know. I think the movie gets a bad rap. Not because of what it is, but because of what it wasn't.
Well, it gets a bad rap for what it is also. It's a good idea with a pretty good first and third act with a really weak second act.
Right.
What I think the biggest thing it gets points on is the ending. The fact that it has that, you know, Carpenter-esque apocalypse.
Absolutely.
End of the world, you don't know what happened kind of ending. You know, the kind of thing audiences hate. But, you know, Carpenter fans love it.
Oh, yeah.
We eat that stuff up.
It's a very Carpenter ending. I mean, even though Carpenter obviously didn't do it, I mean, you know that he had something to do with that. And it's
well, anytime it says produced by John Carpenter, you know, he does read the script. He does right. take notes.
Right.
He does offer suggestions. He did have to score the thing. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. Now, interesting enough, and you know, maybe this isn't necessary, but it was interesting to me that there's a subtext going on here. And you may not agree with this, but I thought I saw something there talking about consumerism and corporate America, and that there's a statement there, you know, in the stuff at the end with the stop it, stop it, stop it. And then he looks straight into the camera and yells, stop it. You know, I felt like that was some sort of a message that was going on there beyond just what was going on.
Well, I was going to say there's your Carpenter influence, because Carpenter's the kind of guy that loves to stick it to the system and to the man. And if he can get it in one of his movies, he'll try. So.
Right. And so you have that element. There's a subtext going on there, I think. And you get that ending. And really, the beauty of that ending and of other Carpenter endings, we saw it in The Thing. We've seen it in They Live. On and on, you know, the A Prince of Darkness.
Prince of Darkness, yeah.
Exactly. You have the What's Going to Happen ending. And really, you know, you can take it one of two ways. A lot of people rationalize and say, oh, well, you know what, maybe a few people were affected. Or you can think in your mind, wow, you know, millions of people saw that third channel going on and their children are dying and the world will never be the same again because of what happened. And maybe Halloween will never be the same again. It'll be deemed an evil holiday forever. You know, and Cochran won. He got what he wanted.
Or maybe 5 seconds later, the station cut that channel and everybody was okay.
And everybody was okay, exactly. But that's
you
the
just
beauty.
Don't know.
That's the beauty.
I think, you know, audiences are so conditioned to that three-act structure with a satisfying conclusion. When you throw them an ending like that,
right.
they think the film is wrong
right.
rather than they're wrong.
Right.
You know, you gotta meet the film head on, and if it makes you think about this, exactly what we did, two or three different alternate possibilities, well, then the film succeeds because you're talking about it, you're thinking about it, you're carrying on long after it's over with. So, I mean, I think that's a sign of a film that's working.
Absolutely, and you know, it's one of my favorite endings ever in a movie. Period. You know, I don't consider it one of my favorite movies, but the ending, absolutely.
Due to Tuesday interruption, we're having technical problems. Please stand by.
It's time.
We are experiencing technical difficulties. Please stand by.
Dark masks, gather round your TV set. Put on your masks and watch. All witches, all skeletons, all jack-o'-lanterns.
The third commercial, it's still on, please. Watch. Take off the third channel, the third channel, it's still running. Stop it, please, for God's sake, please stop it. There's no more time. You've got to, please, stop it. Stop it now, turn it off. Turn it off. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it.
Boogeyman, boogeyman, Jamie's uncle's a boogeyman.
Jamie's an orphan. There it is, Halloween of Jamie's house. Boogeyman, boogeyman.
I tell you, Michael Myers is here in this town. He's here to kill that little girl and anybody who gets in his way.
Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, is 1988. 6 years since Halloween 3. So you're right. What are we doing? There's money to be made here. Other people are making money. And you know that at the end, I mean, you got to understand, everyone's gone. John Carpenter's washed his hands and feet of it. You know, everyone's walked away. They still own the property. They know there's money to be made there. But what are you going to do? You're not going to continue what Carpenter and company wanted to do with the anthology
series. I'll tell you what you're not going to do. There's no fucking way you're going to use the Roman numeral for.
Right.
You're going to make sure everybody knows. And then just in case they're unsure, it'll be The Return of Michael Myers.
Well, look at the poster. It's just one gigantic face of Mike, yeah. Michael Myers' mask, you know? So really, they made absolutely no bones about it. We're going back to the traditional format. and we're going to make this film. Check out the tagline. 10 years ago, he changed the face of Halloween. Tonight, he's back. For some reason, 10 years later, he's got to come out back with it. Donald Pleasance is back.
We are talking about evil on two legs.
Now we're dealing with little Daniel Harris, Jamie Lloyd, who's supposed to be the daughter of Laurie Strode, who has since died in a car accident, right?
Okay, this is where we're going to start veering off into alternate universes.
Exactly.
It's strange when a series can have these, these alternate branches of possibilities. That's what's happening here, because Loomis is dead.
Right.
There's no realistic way to bring him back. I mean, if you don't think about it and they bring him back, and I mean, Michael is what been kept in this, whatever. This is the challenge. It's like, okay, you got to write Halloween 4.
Yeah, that's,
how are you going
to
do it?
Right. You have to make it happen. And that's the point of this movie. It's not that there's a good story out there. It's that you need to go ahead and make this happen. So they hobbled something together, hired a young, inexperienced film director in Dwight H. Little. And really, when you look at this film, now I know that they did ask Carpenter to come back when they were developing the films. And it was Canon Films, believe it or not, was involved for a certain amount of time. And they had even talked about doing a Leatherface versus Michael. And so, you know, we're talking the Verses even way back in 88. But, you know, that didn't happen. So they had to hammer something out, and they came out with this thing. Budget was $5 million, so they got a little money. They have got more money than they've had in the past to make any things. But really, what they brought was nothing. All this is was the same movie, although they exchanged Laurie Strode for a little girl, Jamie. And oh, man. I mean, what can you say? I mean, there's really no reason for us to talk about this film. Because it's really just A to B to C.
Well, I reject it outright because it's not an anamorphic.
Right.
It's the first one in one. It just looks like it's the TV version of Halloween.
Right.
Now.
I know. I always thought, wow, Alan Howard, you know, he's worked with Carpenter. I bet he's great. You know, oh, by himself? Oh, please call John back. At least he did the score.
It took four people to write the story.
Yeah, of what story?
Four people to come up with just patchwork of other movies. That's just amazing to me.
And you got into silliness. Okay, we're still in Haddonfield, okay? And the thing that I love is that Dr. Loomis comes back and they still go, oh, what are you talking about, you crazy old man? They still don't hear him.
And assuming what you say is true.
It's true, Sheriff.
All right, it is true. The hell can we do to avoid a repeat of 10 years ago?
And the house is still there. Why isn't someone burn this house to the ground? Oh, they'll throw rocks at it, but they won't steamroll it. You know, they won't knock it to the ground. Oh, let's keep it up because someone might want to buy it one day. No, they're not. I mean, they will eventually in the series.
And then now the whole series, I mean, it's already taking on supernatural overtones without really dealing with them forthright, although they're going to very soon. How the hell does Michael Myers even know about little Jamie?
Right.
How does he even find her?
He feels her.
Silliness. But this is the point where the whole sister bloodline motivation for Michael Myers really just is out of steam. And I just think it's kind of a hokey plot, ultimately. If you got to go with it, you got to go with it. But boy, it really limits you. Because if his goal is to just kill little Jamie, he goes about it in the worst possible way ever.
Right.
You know, it's like backwards ass. The task could be done so quickly. And then it opens up the question, if he did kill her, what happens next? Is he done?
Is he finished?
Does he evaporate? Is the curse done and over with? I mean, so I don't know. I think that when you start trying to deal with logic and trying to nail something down of why, I think it, you answer some questions and then you open up all these other things that I think just become tacks that you end up stepping on throughout the movie.
Right.
So I don't know. I found 4 really underwhelming, unsatisfying.
Did you not like your hillbilly posse?
I'm going to fry his ass.
Oh.
Granted, this is Illinois, right? Yeah, there's a honky tonk right down the street. where everyone's all liquored up, and they're like, let's go get us some Michael Myers. Okay? And the sheriff's like, no, go back, and then Loomis is like, you need them.
You haven't got a police force.
And then we get to see them going out on the streets. Oh, great.
Hey, I got a town full of beer bellies running around in the dark with shotguns.
And they're blowing away citizens because they say, hey, look, I saw him over there.
I seen his face. Right there, Al. Right there in those bushes.
I mean, it's just like, it's like brain numbing. It's like head slap stupid. And the acting is just, it's in the floor. I mean, it's hideous.
Well, tonight we're going to do something better.
All the way across. Especially, Jamie's got a new friend now. Maybe the Lori-like sister or that's supposed to be kind of her mother. Oh, God, what is her name? Rachel.
How about this afternoon I pick you up from school and we go get ice cream?
Double scoops?
Double scoops. Now let's get some breakfast.
And they try to make her a main character, and she's just so unappealing and so terrible.
But that doesn't mean that I love you any less.
And
Michael is just so smart, and he's everywhere in this movie.
Right.
No logic of how he got there. He's just there, and boy, his timing is excellent.
Right.
Ugh.
Well, yeah, this is really the movie for me when I said that the characters were so dumb and so boring that I was happy when Michael finally got his hands on them.
Oh yeah, I agree.
The teenager boyfriend of of Rachel, and Michael finally gets him, and you're like, yeah, kill him, Michael, kill him. And I mean, at first that throws you off because you're like, I shouldn't be feeling this way. I'm supposed to be rooting for the good side. I'm not supposed to be rooting for evil to kill people. But I think that it's just so poorly done, and you know, it's either so poorly done or it's meant for me to feel that way that I want them to die. I don't think that was the case in this film. But I mean, other things that just bad mask continuity, like we said before, from shot to shot, the mask looks so totally different.
The mask is horrible. It completely takes me out of it. It's not even a Halloween movie.
Right.
I mean, when I was in eighth grade, I wanted to go as the Shape for Halloween. I made myself my own mask out of like paper mache. It was better than the mask in that movie. That mask was so bad.
So yeah, I mean, and it's just over and over. It's a movie made for money. I mean, they had a bigger budget, but they didn't have the talent, and so they created this arc though that would go over three films, and they ended this thing knowing that they were going to have a five because they had a little sting at the end where Jamie apparently gets possessed by Michael or by his rage or something, like Loomis likes to call it.
Well, they're able to echo the first movie that way, and she's in the same little clown outfit
right.
that little Mikey was,
right.
and she's able to put the little mask over the lens and with the two eye
right.
slits again and,
right.
All that.
Well, and to me, that's really the only moment that I was even interested in almost in the entire film that I wasn't just so bored. I liked Loomis's reaction to her. He starts screaming, no, no, no.
No! 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 No!
And he points the gun at her. He's going to kill her. He's like, I can't take this anymore. I'm not going to do this again and spend years watching another child become, a maniac like Michael Myers. And the sheriff stops him and... And then, of course, we've got our cliffhanger over to Halloween 5.
And again, the supernatural is front and center now. That's the only way to explain Jamie's behavior.
Right.
There's no reason why she'd need to pick up a knife and just suddenly go kill her mom.
Exactly. Well, remember when she touched his hand and something was transferred.
But again, there's no reason why in the first movie, why did Michael want to kill her there?
Right, exactly.
This is where it all gets kind of cloudy.
God damn you.
Every time a little girl twitches, I'm supposed to call out the National Guard.
How many people did he kill last year? Have you forgotten?
Don't you stay the night?
Oh, I'm sorry, I gotta run.
Tina, please.
Stay away, okay? You're really creepy, filling that little girl with all that boogeyman crap.
I believe that you're in danger. Jamie believes it, too.
Jamie's a 9-year-old girl.
Be sensible.
I'm never sensible if I can help it.
Tina!
The movie is Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers, 1989, 1 year after Halloween 4. Tagline this time, Michael lives, and this time, they're ready.
They're ready. Yeah, and so is the audience.
Now, interesting enough, they brought on a French director. They said, oh, no, we want to make this a higher quality film. Some guy named Dominique Othon Girard. You're right, and you got those slashes. And you know what? You start the movie with those slashes, and I'm thinking, oh, that's kind of cool. I like that.
Hey, believe me, you and I, we saw a lot of movies together back then.
Right.
Because this is our college years.
Right.
And we didn't see that kind of aggressive cutting in movies, feature film movies. You just didn't see it that often.
Right.
If at all. So it is some pretty good fast cutting in a way.
Yeah.
You know, some flash frames. And because it's all the carving of the pumpkin. So it is a nice homage in that sense.
Yeah.
To the original opening credits of Halloween, of going back to the whole pumpkin idea,
yeah.
there's a sense of some stylistic promise. And I do think the film is visually far more interesting than Part 4, which is really just kind of bland.
I would put Part 4 as I would almost call it the worst. Almost.
I mean, the lighting is more naturalistic, and it's darker, a lot more shadows.
Right.
The camera angles, the coverage of scenes, and the editing is far more aggressive in this film than any Halloween film to this date so far.
Right.
I mean, this is the one where there's just really a lot more juice and tension in terms of the pacing and the way the shots are constructed to jolt you and to get effects out of you.
Now, but ultimately, all that's kind of wasted on probably the most boring Halloween film there is.
Oh, I agree. This film looks like to me it had a lot of post-production problems, because do you think when the director was staging those scenes with the cops, he was hearing those comedy sound effects on the soundtrack?
Oh.
All clear.
Nothing above, nothing below.
Whose idea was to put those in?
I was amazed.
Oh, it's just so bad.
I know. I was totally amazed when I saw that.
I mean, like little, whistles and, hoot hoots.
These are the bumblers, yeah. They're going to bumble everything. Oh.
Rescue cats.
Find dogs.
That's their job.
And we love it.
Great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, apparently this was the least successful of all of the Halloween films, even more so than 3. I think a lot of people just, maybe they weren't interested in this arc,
Why did we go see it?
We saw everything.
He dragged me to this thing we saw this in Shocker on the same night.
We saw whatever we needed to see back then. Get us to a movie. But, oh man, and you got your terrible score by Alan Howarth again, very dinky, bad sounding.
Oh, it's, ding, ding, ding.
Terrible acting. You've got your Demi Moore lookalike, who was, rather hot.
Her acting really annoyed me in the film, if you even want to call it acting.
Stay away, okay? You're really creepy filling that little girl with all that boogeyman crap.
I find that just loud. It's like, to me, it's the fingernails on a chalkboard. Oh, it was just really grating.
And you also had Dr. Loomis back again, and he went nuts in this movie. I mean, he didn't act like he acted before. Remember, he's all up in Jamie's face all the time. Tell us what you're thinking.
Jamie, please.
He's really creepy. Maybe it's because Donald Pleasance was trying to create growth in the character and make him a little more insane. But, it was grating after a while. I was like, man, back off.
Please.
You're not the same strong force you used to be.
Jamie, please.
Well, and another thing, it's the characters again, too. That Tina character.
Oh, I know.
She's so selfish and so annoying. And there's Jamie is breaking down in tears, begging her not to leave her.
Tina!
No, I gotta go. I gotta go party.
Tina, don't go.
I have to.
Why?
Because. You might not understand, but when you're older, there are people you're gonna meet who make you feel, connected. Like your heart is made of neon, and when you find them, you have to be with them.
Ooh, danger. I gotta go do my thing.
Yeah, there's certain people that make my soul feel beautiful. I have to go to that. It's like, she just saved your ass from Michael Myers just ripping your head off. Oh.
And, so when the tables are turned on her, I don't feel sorry for her.
No.
She had every opportunity to avoid this tonight, but oh no, her decisions got her into this predicament. So, you know what? Get it over with, Michael. Please.
Tina, no.
She's annoying. I just, and I don't like that watching the movie to where I'm rooting for the killer to kill the annoying characters on screen, but that's the way it is. You just, you can't care about these characters. They're all stock. There's really, there's nothing interesting that they're allowed to do in these movies.
This one, more so than any of the films, was that way. I wanted them all to die. They
and there's
were all
fake scares. It's like, is he there? Is he not there? Is she seeing him? Is he not? Is she not seeing him? At least in the first Carpenter movie, they didn't cheat. It's like, he's out the window. She sees him. She looks back. He's not there.
Right.
It's not like, is he? Was he in the room all along, or was it another dream or hallucination or whatnot? It's just any excuse to juice you or scare you. Dambi logic, steamroll ahead.
Well, and that's the deal. I mean, it's just so lightweight and so pointless. And then we get to the point where they say, okay, the only thing that we can do is capture him, okay? So we're gonna put Jamie on the line and we're gonna lure him to the house.
Michael, go home! Go home!
Go home if you want to get rid of all this rage. And so he goes home, they set up the trap. You know, I mean, Who can kill him? I mean, he's like a Terminator.
Fuck you, asshole.
I mean, I think that's really what Michael Myers is. He's a Terminator.
Well, the whole movie opens up with him as Rambo in that freaking well. Why would he crawl out and go into those rapids? He knew dynamite was coming?
Rambo.
I'm coming to get you.
Well, and that's another thing that drove me crazy. Remember, that was so confusing. He went and lived with that kind of bum guy for a while?
That old man that healed his wounds or something?
Yeah, and it said 1 year later. What? Michael's been sleeping for a year? He's been unconscious for a year? Living in this place? I mean, what, he only comes to life on Halloween? I mean, come on. That was so confusing. Why does it, the year matter? It's like 1 year, it's 10 years. 1 year, it's 1 year. Oh, and he's back the next year.
The series is tired. It's out of steam, and it shows.
Well, but they did try to offer an element of something different here. The Man in Black.
Mr. Boots.
Mr. Boots. Remember, this is the thing. When he showed up, and in the end, they ended the movie with Mr. Boots breaking Michael out of jail, we're like, who the hell is Mr. Boots? So there's your cliffhanger, this story that we don't know what's going on. And the funny thing is that the writers didn't know what was going on either. Nobody did. Wrote it in as something. We'll figure it out later.
Yeah, we don't want to end our series, you know, when this is our bread and butter.
Exactly.
They didn't know if it was going to be a hit or not.
Exactly. And it wasn't.
But they knew suckers like you and I would go see it.
This force, this thing that lived inside of him came from a source too violent, too deadly for you to imagine. It.
So it keeps going. Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, 1995. Now, 6 years, 6 years we had to wait to find out who the hell the man in the boots was, who the hell the man in black was. We didn't know.
I guess we can thank Dimension Films. Didn't they buy the rights?
They bought the rights and it moved to a new house, Dimension. Now, they obviously didn't have to keep the storyline, but they decided, yes, we're going to keep this storyline with the tagline, six times the terror. Six times the fear. And six times the thrill.
Halloween 666. The curse of Michael Myers. Kill for him.
Mommy!
Ooh.
And the funny thing is, at this point, we have the curse, we have the revenge, we have the return. Does this sound like any other series you've ever heard?
What is this, the Pink Panther?
Exactly. Halloween, directed by Blake Edwards.
God.
But believe it or not, and here's the crazy thing. We get to Six, and you think it's just going to be the same old thing. I actually kind of enjoyed Six. You know, it's one of the few of the series that I actually enjoyed. Now, one of the big contentions of this film is that there's two different versions, very different versions of this film, the theatrical cut and the producer's cut. And
not director's cut.
No, not director's cut. The director likes the theatrical, which is interesting. So, but the producer's cut is a hard thing to find. It's out there in the black market. Now, you've gotten us a copy. Thank you. And I've seen it. Believe it or not, this movie actually has some sort of substance to it, or they're trying to. Now, granted, it's all this druid cult stuff, and ultimately that's who the Man in Black is. He says the leader of this druid cult who protects Michael, and there's all this deep storyline with the druids and the astrological signs, and there's that marking that Michael has on his hands.
According to Celtic legend, one child from each tribe was chosen to be inflicted with the curse of Thorn, to offer the blood sacrifices of its next of kin on the night of Samhain.
Halloween.
The sacrifice of one family meant sparing the lives of an entire tribe. For years, I've been convinced there must be some reason, some method behind Michael's madness. The druids were also great mathematicians and astronomers, but the Thorn symbol is actually a constellation of stars that appears from time to time on Halloween night. Whenever it appears, he appears. Coincidence?
Heck, not only that, you got, you know, the brother of, you know, the Strode brother, and they're living in the house. What you have is, like, whoever got the writing assignment. I mean, they're trying to write a story around it, a situation that's not just a rehash of the other movies. It doesn't have the same kind of flow and pace that the other one does. It really feels, you know, like a very different movie. But then you have Tommy coming back in as a major character. So it feels connected in a way to the other films, and it still has to deal with the baggage of the Man in Black, what they've been hinting with the druids, and boy, it really takes it further in terms of exploring that Michael is like an instrument being used by these people to carry out deeds in a way. I mean, did you get the feeling that Michael impregnated?
Yeah, I kind of got that idea that he impregnated Jamie, because Jamie's been captured by the druid cult. Everyone thought she died at the end of five, but no, Jamie was captured by the cult.
Yeah.
So
that's Michael's baby, isn't it?
That's what I figured.
I think there was a flashback scene in the producer's cut that alluded to, like, you know, Michael was made to impregnate her or something.
Right, yeah.
See, that's the whole thing. It's like, which version are we talking about? Which one is the real one?
Right.
But I have to go with the gut level of the first script that they wrote. They shot all this stuff. They cut it together.
Mm-hmm.
And someone, some test audience out there, some 14-year-old kid said, hey, I don't like it. That Loomis guy is boring to me.
Right, exactly.
So they cut it, you know? And so that, to me, whatever film they cut after the test screening, that wasn't the Halloween film they set out to make. That's the one they were willing to settle for to get it out and make their buck and to try and, you know, make it play in their marketplace.
Right.
But I champion the bravery. At least they set out to try and make something different. So I got to look at the producer's cut as the original intent for what this Halloween movie, you know, is. And I think, you know, probably the same thing will come up when we talk about the remake as well.
Right. Well, and it's really the origin story. And they want to tell you, why is Michael like he is? Why did he kill his family? And all that. They're trying to answer those questions and try to make it make sense. Although that's hard to do, having gone and done, you know, four and five, and still try to keep that continuity. I think they did a pretty decent job of it. Now, in the theatrical cut, however, really what they've done is, in lieu of a lot of the story, you don't get a lot of the druid scenes where they're all there in the, you know what I mean, and doing all that. You get more of, like, chase scenes. There's some big, massive chase scenes, and it's really just more action, more Michael stalking them. You know, this is the one where Michael runs a little bit even. And so, really, they threw out a lot of the more stronger story elements, shortened all that down, shortened Loomis almost out of the plot altogether, and just made it more visceral and more action-oriented.
And they added those little flash frames.
Right, exactly. Wham, wham, wham.
You remember seeing those?
Yeah, it's like, hurry it up, quicker, make it faster. So, and I think the stylistic in this film is actually pretty strong. Joe Chappelle
I think Joe Chappelle, didn't he go on and do like The Wire or The Shield nowadays?
He did CSI Miami, CSI New York. He might be doing The Wire. I know he did Hellraiser Bloodline.
He did Phantoms.
Phantoms. Yeah.
Phantoms.
Ben Affleck. The Skulls 2. I don't know. I think this film, at least the producer's cut, is trying to go deeper and trying to tell you more. It was somewhat satisfying finding out who the man and was, and it ultimately ended up being the person in charge of the sanitarium.
You are a madman.
I've had my failures, but this baby, Jamie's baby, we are at the dawn of a new age, Sam. And I'm asking you to join me.
Now, the thing that still throws me, we're talking producer's cut again, is apparently the curse is handed off to Dr. Loomis. Did you get that?
Yes, I did.
And Dr. Loomis...
And Michael becomes the man in black, right?
Michael becomes the man in black, and Loomis becomes Michael.
Right,
so it made
right.
me think that, Dr. Loomis was going to be the killer. Now, they didn't like that, and so in the theatrical, you just see them all say... When they leave, when Paul Rudd and everybody else leaves to go as far away as they can from Haddonfield, apparently... He just says, goodbye, I'll see you later. And, there's not that transition. Now, sadly, we know that after this film is when Donald Pleasance passed away. And so that would be the end of him in the Halloween series. So, I mean, I guess it makes sense. You don't want to necessarily end with him in this terrible role. But it definitely...
I know, it's very Carpenter-esque.
It's very Carpenter-esque. It makes it dark. And, it is kind of strong. So... I don't know where they stand. I really believe that they need to release that producer's cut and at least make both versions available for people to choose. I know that, seeing some panels on it they've said, we totally, and the cast and the crew are behind this producer's cut. To them, that's the version of the film.
Someone, anyone, help me. Dr. Loomis, are you out there? Can you hear me, Dr. Loomis? I need your help. God, please help.
Oh,
damn it!
Oh, Miss Tate, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to make you jump.
It's okay.
Well, hey, it's Halloween. I guess everyone's entitled to one good scare.
I've had my share. My brother killed my sister when she was 17.
Well, that's sucky. How'd he do that?
With a really big, sharp kitchen knife.
I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding. Even the most rudimentary sense of life and death, of good or evil, right or wrong. I met this six-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes.
The film is called Halloween H2O. This is Halloween 7.
20 years later.
1998. I always wondered at the beginning, what does water have to do with it, But yeah, H2O, 20 years later. This is 3 years after Halloween 6. Now, what's the smartest thing you can do if you want to get away from where they've been going and taking the Halloween series? Just ignore the other movies altogether. They never happened, right?
Never happened.
So is it a reboot? Or is it just kind of them saying, well, this maybe happened over here, but they never lead on. They state in this film, in H2O, that basically Michael has not been seen or heard from in 20 years.
Well, this is the Aliens idea. It's taking the Laurie Strode character and bringing her back and establishing her, what she's up to, what she went through, and throwing her worst nightmare right back face to face with her.
Right.
And this time she has to deal with it. It worked out nicely in terms of the fact that it was 20 years, and we don't really know what happened to Jamie Lee's character. And
Well, no. The fact that she's got a daughter and all that, you really have to ignore 4, 5, and 6. But so right, what? Right. You know, alternate universe. We do it for superheroes. I guess we could do it for, you know, serial killers named Michael Myers also.
Right.
To me, it kind of felt like a real film again. You know, right. it was interesting to, just as an idea, to see what Laurie Strode would be up to and how she dealt with the nightmares of having that happened to her. Mm-hmm. Again, you deal head on with the whole sister element. You got to embrace it by this point, right?
Right.
Because that's the only reason to have Michael come back to haunt again. And, you know, what this film doesn't try and do is answer any questions. It doesn't try and say, oh, this is where Michael's been hiding out all these years, you know?
Exactly.
And it's in California, too. It's not even in Haddonfield. Right.
He walked a hell of a long way. Or stole a car.
We did see him steal cars in this. Right. So.
Well, remember at the beginning, we open up on our nurse from Halloween 1 and 2. And, you know, just so we're back in the whole universe of Halloween 1 and 2. You know, and we're erasing 4, 5, and 6.
And we need some kills in the first 10 minutes anyway, or 12 minutes.
Exactly.
So this works as a great little opener. And it is nice that it ties in, you know, gets that character back.
And there's that file again.
The file.
Exactly.
But he does get the information, and he's able to, at least plot-wise, it's plausible of how did he know where she is.
Right.
So, you know, it works. And, you know, it might have been nice if Loomis was still alive. Michael could have killed Loomis in that scene.
Right.
Who knows? But... you know, the film is off and running. It's not a long film, which it doesn't need to be. You know, it spends a lot of time developing the character of Laurie and, you know, where she's at. And
see, and that's my only problem.
You know, the teenager kids.
We spend all this time developing these characters. Now, yes, Laurie Strode is important and what she's been up to. Of course, we have to suffer through Josh Hartnett, you know, my favorite actor.
And introducing Josh Hartnett.
Oh, God. So, yeah, we do get to see Michelle Williams, who plays his girlfriend, who's rather hot on the hot side.
Got to give a nod to Jodie Lynn O'Keefe as well.
Definitely. And we get a little bit of stunt casting because we get Janet Leigh in here.
Oh, and then that's so nice with her driving the original car from Psycho.
And Steve Miner, the director, wanted to do all these little, you know, tip of the hats back to different things in Psycho and whatnot. And I guess that's their prerogative.
Oh, yeah.
And some people might think it's neat seeing Janet Leigh and Jamie Lee together because they're mother and daughter, because one's from Psycho, one's from Halloween.
But you know how many people don't even know?
For those in the know, it's kind of a nifty little homage. It's a kind of a nifty little thing. I didn't know about it until I read the notes afterwards, you know, got into it. But,
yeah.
You know, we got LL Cool J. You know, finally we got an actual black man in this movie. Can you believe it? Black people are in the world of Halloween now. Of course, you know, he's kind of a magic black man, just like we're going to see later on with Busta Rhymes, because he can get shot and live. You know?
Test audiences want to see him live.
It's like, no, LL got killed. You know?
Reshoots, man. He lives this time.
It's like, wow, you can get blown away and live. You're like Michael.
Like the first film, I think it has a lot of nice echoes.
Yeah, but it's build-up of these characters who ultimately, eventually we get to a point, okay, Michael is here, and then boom, the gauntlet is dropped. And it's the same thing as before, the pick-off. We're going to pick off this kid, we're going to pick off that kid, and we're going to slowly get around to where we finally get...
Except now we have the school instead of the hospital or the houses,
right.
You know.
But, you know...
Gives us a new environment.
Lori couldn't understand it for the longest time, you know, and it's like, okay, now she finally sees this here. I kind of like the scene where he's walking toward her, Michael's walking toward her, and she kind of shakes her head, like, no, it's not him. And then she closes her eyes again. No, that's not him. You know,
oh, yeah,
when
yeah.
It actually is him coming toward her. So that's interesting. I think really where this film turns the corner, because I almost think that the beginning of it is a waste of time. Because, yes, it's showing us these characters who ultimately I don't care about. Josh Hartnett, the kids. Just keep it on Laurie, you know. And but there's that point where the corner turns. When she's teaching her class and... Michelle Williams gets this little point where she talks about fate. It's having to do with Frankenstein and how, you know, he finally should have attacked his monster.
But I think that Victor should have confronted the monster sooner. I mean, he's completely responsible for Elizabeth's death. He was so paralyzed by fear that he never did anything. It took death for the guy to get a clue.
And why do you think he was finally able to confront his monster? Well, I think that Victor had reached a point in his life where he had nothing left to lose. I mean, the monster saw to that by killing off everybody that he loved. Victor finally had to face it. It was about redemption. It was his fate.
And that's that fulcrum point where Laurie needed to hear that moment. And that really changes the aspect of the film, which I thought was very strong.
Well, in that point, when she sends them off and she closes that gate and grabs that axe,
yeah,
suddenly we're in a new territory for a Halloween movie.
Right.
We haven't seen this.
Right. That makes it a new
And so, film. Yeah, the stakes have changed. So suddenly now we're finally getting a sequel.
Right, exactly. This
that
is the first
isn't
sequel.
A rehash.
This is the first sequel since Halloween 2, exactly.
Well, and, you know, it's really since Halloween, if you really want to get technical.
Well, we can forget Halloween 2 if we really want to.
I would like to forget Halloween 2, so. But, I mean, I think the idea in this movie is what Halloween 2 should have been anyway.
Right.
The central idea of again, haunting her several years later.
Right.
But I think the final showdown between the both of them is fine.
I have a few scenes that I really love, but one of them was when that first moment where they're looking through that window and Laurie and Michael go face to face. And I'm like, oh, that was a great moment. That was like, yes, that's what I want to see. And, you know, really it becomes a war. You know, when she's walking out there and she's dragging that axe, like you said, and she's yelling, Michael! I mean, you're really going, this is like fucking Ripley.
Well, of course it is. That's where they got the idea from.
Get away from her, you bitch! You know? I mean, and that's where the movie is strong. And so really, I'm kind of like, you know, hey, just give me the last part of the movie where it's the war. It's almost like Halloween 2 again, where it's like, okay, can we get to the main event when we finally get Laurie versus Michael? That's the essence of Halloween, and that's what makes it strong.
Well, see, I don't mind the character stuff with Laurie and all that. I think it's interesting to revisit, you know, where she's at. Mm-hmm. And it's only appropriate that you should try and develop some of the supporting characters as much as you can. Mm-hmm. In this type of film. For what it is, I think it works, and I think it accomplishes it what it set out to do. I think it was a good choice to get Steve Miner in there. Again, he brings back the anamorphic.
Right.
So Halloween looks right again. Mm-hmm. You know, it just it looks and feels right. It is the cleanest, most polished of all of them. So it's got that Hollywood sheen look to it.
It does, and that throws me ultimately, because I'm so used to the low-budget look of a Halloween film.
Yeah, it looks like a real movie.
It's like a real movie. Well, and it's got an orchestral score by John Ottman that's just so full. And it's kind of like, oh, man, take me back to the, you know, my John Carpenter electronic, you know. It's at least better than Alan Howarth's crap. But it is. It's a really full movie. It's a clean movie. And that threw me
at
first.
And it's short. It's brief. It doesn't try and overstay its welcome.
No.
I mean, I think it's a nice little turn when she steals the ambulance with the body. You know?
She's fucking smart. She knows this guy's going to come back to life. And then ultimately, come on. Oh, what a great ending. You know, I loved this ending. I love this ending more than possibly than even part three. I mean, just come on. You know, I love the hand reach out. I love the almost touching, you know, and the emotion swelling up. You know what I mean? And then, whack!
Yep. Let's see it come back from that one, Michael.
Yeah, exactly. Loved it. And then, you know, the head hits the ground. We see Jamie turn around. The music instantly starts. It's the electronic score from John Carpenter. Oh, and then boom, go to credits. Man, I was in love with that movie right then at that point. I'm like, that's right. You know, kicked his ass finally. So completely satisfying. I don't think it's a great movie altogether, but that last, you know, 30 minutes or
whatever. I think out of all the sequels we've been talking about, it's the first one I found satisfying.
Right. Oh, definitely.
As all, from watching it, and it's like, okay, if you got to make a sequel to Halloween, I thought this was probably the best on paper and the best executed that we've seen.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And, well, I don't know if that statement's going to, well, I know that statement won't change when the next one is made as well.
You've heard of the tunnel. The one we all go through sooner or later. At the end, there's a door. And waiting for you on the other side of that door is either heaven or hell. This is that door.
Halloween 8, Resurrection, 2002, 4 years after H2O. Tagline, evil finds its way home. Okay. First off, what you're going to do is you're going to bring back Rick Rosenthal from part two. Mistake. It's been 21 years. I would hope he would have gotten better by this.
Well, I would say to his credit, though, considering all the elements he had to deal with in this film, with all the, you know, again, the camera and aliens video units, you know, all the multiple perspectives and whatnot.
Right.
I mean, I think his direction is a lot better than like 4 and 5.
Oh, of course. You can't compare it to 4 and 5. But ultimately, come on. Number one, let's start off
it's
by...
It's a come down, though, from H2O. That's the problem.
Well, here's the problem. No, let me get this bitch out. Let me rant for a second. Is that, number one, the only way that you're going to make this movie is to what? Destroy my lovely happy ending from H2O?
Yeah, you completely have to destroy
you
it.
You have to destroy my happy, wonderful ending. By what? Cheating. They call it what? They call it a retcon. You know? They go back and they say, okay, this is the way it was, but we're going to cheat it. And we're gonna tell you that was false. It wasn't really.
It's
Michael.
Even a bigger cheat than Loomis living, and that's a big cheat.
It's the worst cheat in the entire series, and not only that,
it's the worst cheat in movies.
It's disgusting, and I hated it because it took away my movement. And the only way that I can live is the fact that in my mind, Halloween Resurrection is deleted. It's Cocoon the Return. Okay, you have to just take that part out of your head because I was so disgusted that they played that card and said, oh, that wasn't really Michael that she chopped his head off. That was, you know, a medic that Michael changed places with. Give me a break. And that same medic, you know, woke up after being, you know, stabbed or whatever. His larynx was crushed by Michael. He's thrown through a window at top speed. He gets up. He's hit by a car. He rolls down the thing. He's crushed by the car in the tree. To where he can stay alive for a few moments. Yeah, sorry, that was Michael Myers, and he got his damn head chopped off. That wasn't a medic.
So let me ask you this. If they came to you and said, okay, you have to solve the problem.
Right.
You got to write, you know, Halloween 8 or whatever, okay?
Right.
I mean, the concept for the movie is at least different. Doing the idea of the Michael going back to the house...
Right.
Going, you know, with the reality show, trying to combine this Big Brother, Survivor, Blair Witch, mm-hmm. you know, concept in there, you know, knowing that you don't have any of the other threads to kind of deal with. I mean, I didn't think it was like 100% lame, you know. It's not great either, but at least
no.
It's trying to do something different.
It is trying to do something different.
But how do you bring back Michael? I don't know how I could have solved it either, because it does seem pretty final. You have to come up with something as cheesy and stupid. Either that or he picks up his head, puts it back on his body, and walks away. And that's worse, you
right.
know? It's
yeah,
worse.
I don't know how you do it. I mean, I, from the way that it looked to me, they were willing to depart the series at H2O. You know, and I'm kind of a little pissed at Jamie Lee for being in this movie, for saying, oh no, that whole last movie was bullshit. And now she's crazy, and we have to have the goodbye scene to her.
I'll see you in hell.
Thank you.
You know, it's like, oh, well, we're finally going to, you know, this is her Alien 3. We've got to end her. You know, she's got to be, you know, finally put away with. But to me, if Laurie Strode is dead, what's this point? Isn't that his fuel? Isn't that his fire? And hasn't it been from part one was to get to Sister and kill her? Okay, so we kill Sister. We wave goodbye to the Laurie Strode thread. And yet he's still going, right?
Well, technically, if it's about bloodlines, he should be going after her son. If you're going to continue with, you know, that kind of logic.
Okay, but he doesn't. But,
you know, Josh Hartnett's not coming back, so that's out. Yeah. You know, unless you want to recast.
Right.
So, no, I mean, you're right. And I think they were setting up some interesting Sarah Connor ideas with her.
Sure.
You know, in the asylum at the very beginning, not taking her pills and all that. And, I mean, I really think that, okay, once we get over the fact that, okay, Michael didn't die, he is back, you could have made a more interesting Laurie Strode movie again. You still had another Laurie Strode movie in this, I think.
Well, like you said,
of her dealing with the psychology of killing an innocent person, Michael's still out there, and she goes completely crazy, and then she starts mirroring him.
She's hunting him. That's your movie right there, not this. But, I mean, I read that Jamie Lee was contractually – she had to do like a 30-second cameo, but she liked the script so much she went ahead and was in it for, what, 5 minutes or whatever?
And Laurie's so damn smart. I love it. She knows Shape is coming.
Right.
She preps for him. When he comes, she's not scared. She's ready. Hell, she's got a booby trap ready on the roof.
Exactly.
And what happens? Shape falls right into him. Man, she's got him. And you're loving it because you haven't seen this yet in a Halloween movie.
Right.
So although there's the utter stupidity of completely ignoring the ending of H2O, I'm not minding what I'm seeing in this like little 12-minute prologue.
But then what happens?
She reaches for the mask.
Exactly.
I have to be sure. Now, let me tell you something, honey. This guy just broke into your room, okay? Tried to get at you and chased you up to the roof. I don't care who he is. He's going down.
That's what I mean. I think everyone would kind of look past the fact you're already in the sanitarium. Who fucking cares at this point? He's got blood on his knife. He looks like your brother with the mask and everything. You know what? Just take him out. If it's the wrong guy, well, then he was an asshole and he deserved it. Because you don't walk around Laurie Strode looking like Michael Myers and expect to get away with it. Sorry. So, yeah.
No, and I thought there were some nice touches in the screenplay. One of the lines I thought was really kind of funny was, you know, when they were trying to figure out Michael Myers. And some guy says, the devil made him do it. End of story.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's perfect.
Perfect.
Because that's all you need, you know.
Exactly.
You don't really need to explain it more than that. It was, you know, and I kind of liked the guy in the asylum too. He was had all the facts for the serial killers.
Michael Myers, born October 19th, 1957.
Yeah.
But it's kind of stupid when Michael just hands him the knife and all that.
Go and kill. Well, and you know what?
But,
really, and then we flip the script and we get with the Dangertainment.
Okay. I'd like to start this off by saying the search is over. You six have been selected to explore America's worst nightmare. Tomorrow night, Halloween, live in front of the whole entire internet universe, you six will enter the birthplace of evil in its purest form, the childhood home of our most brutal mass murderer, Michael Myers.
And this basic idea that, like you said, is a unique and different idea. They're trying to do it to the MTV culture with youth and everything. But it's the damn execution. Whose brilliant idea was it for top billing to go to Busta Rhymes?
I'm bet he's a big Halloween fan.
You know?
Couldn't wait to take on Michael Myers.
Trick or treat, motherfucker.
You know, I mean, oh, the lines and the overacting. And, you know, I don't hate Busta Rhymes. He's got some fun rap videos and some music sometimes. I just, it was like head slap moronic every time the man opened his mouth. It was like he was improvising. And I could see him doing that. Damn, I'm Busta Rhymes. I don't need no damn script.
God damn it.
He probably improvised every single line. You know? And
like
it's just,
Mikey?
Oh,
hey, Mikey?
Yeah, happy Halloween, Mikey.
Hey, Mikey! Happy fucking Halloween!
And I love the scene where Michael's burning at the end, and he looks at him and goes, "Burn, motherfucker! Burn!" It's supposed to be like, "The roof! The roof! The roof is on fire!" And it's just like, oh, God. Just the reference and everything. And to top that, you know who is worse? Fucking Tyra Banks! What? How annoying can a human being be?
We are doing our thing.
Oh! Every time she was on the screen, I just wanted to slice my neck with one of Michael's butcher knives. You know?
And how about Starbuck as a girl?
Did you see the boogeyman or something?
She's gorgeous and hot, so I was glad to see Katie Sackhoff in this, although her character was as dumb as a board. Uh-huh. She had one of the more graphic death scenes. I'm sure she got a kick out of getting her head completely chopped off. You want to talk about beat your head stupid? How about the Deckard guy?
Oh, I know.
You know, the guy watching on the computer at home and calling in updates.
No, at the party where everyone is like joining in. Ooh, yeah. Is it real or is it?
And it's so great because remember Busta at the beginning is all about, what do you mean you don't want to be famous?
What do you mean you don't want to be famous? That's the American dream.
He's trying to push all this stuff. And then at the end, he's like,
Michael Myers is not a soundbite, a spinoff, a tie-in, some kind of celebrity scandal.
He's a real killer. He's a killer shark.
Michael Myers is a killer shark.
What? It's like, God, it's like, how much more brain numbing can it be? I mean, it really
can you imagine
like
the script girl on the set just like nodding her head like going, oh God, yeah, here we go.
Yeah, killer shark, not in the script, Busta.
Michael Myers is a killer shark. Baggy ass overalls.
You know, he's going to Rick saying, yo, Rick, I got this line. I'm going to call him Killer Shark, Mikey, and all this. And it's just like Rosenthal must have lost all control on that set because it's like, okay, decent idea, but absolutely brain-numbingly moronic. I mean, to me, worst film of all of them. Worst.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, 4 is pretty bad and boring. I mean,
yeah, it's boring, but it's not like moronic. This is moronic.
Yeah, but the opening prologue is still better than anything in like 4.
Oh, definitely. But it's almost a short film that's separate from the rest of the film, you know? And they even got a guy come back. You know, I've been listening to the scores a little bit, and the musical score, if you can get it in for 2 seconds beyond all of the godforsaken pop hit songs that they were trying to sell. The music score by a guy named Danny Lux is actually, it's very full sounding. It's actually a pretty decent score. But it's just, you know, again, it's execution. It's the loss of control. I think ultimately that's what killed it was the fact that the casting was so off. I don't know what they were going for with their casting. Youth, urban, or what. Check this out. I thought this was hilarious. It garnered an 11% on RottenTomatoes.com. Lou Limerick of the New York Post said, "It's so devoid of joy and energy, it makes Jason X look positively Shakespearean by comparison."
Wow. Amazing.
So, I mean, I think really that's the problem. And so, I mean, the only way I can really...
Is that death of a franchise?
Well, obviously it was. Like, what can we do at this point? Well, the only thing we can do is reboot the whole damn thing.
These eyes will deceive you. They will destroy you. They will take from you your innocence, your pride, and eventually your soul. These eyes do not see what you and I see. Behind these eyes, one finds only blackness. The absence of light. These are the eyes of a psychopath.
Halloween 9, if you will. 2007, 5 years after Resurrection, tagline, evil has a destiny. And this time we're going to get Rob Zombie from House of a Thousand Corpses, Devil Rejects. Now, part of the reason this thing took so long to get going was Mustafa Akkad died. Sadly.
Yeah, that was tragic.
Well, it was sad. I mean, it was from a terrorist attack in Jordan.
I know.
It's not like he was sick or anything. He was attacked and he eventually died of his wounds. And I mean, God, how horrible is that? But, you know, Malik wants to continue on. It's the family breadwinner.
And Malik's an interesting name because when you start reading all the credits, he was just like a production assistant. And then he's an associate producer. And then a co-producer. And then he's a producer. And now he's the man.
Yeah, he's grown up in daddy's business. And so here he is now. And, you know, of course we've got the Weinsteins along. And that's what we didn't mention before, is that we've had the Weinsteins on for three films at this point.
Well, ever since, yeah, Dimension came on, that's Bob Weinstein's, you know, playhouse.
Right.
You know, you got to remember, the Weinsteins made a fortune off of Scream.
Right.
Three of them. And Kevin Williamson, who wrote the first Scream, was involved in H2O, mm-hmm. in the making. I mean, Halloween is like his Citizen Kane anyway. He loves the film. I'm sure Dimension has been toying around with trying to get a Halloween 9 off the ground.
Right, but what do you do? Isn't that really the big question after every single Halloween, is how are we going to keep this dead dog going? How can we continue mm-hmm. to keep this thing fresh? You know, I mean, they're smart not to do like part 4 and part 5, you know, to just make the same movie over and over and to add a new dimension. But I think you just hit a wall after the complete idiocy of Resurrection, to where he's saying, what can we possibly do? And I mean, so as we know, reboots are all in fashion now, so let's hire someone who's got a crazy vision out there to do this. And I'm not saying that Rob Zombie was a terrible choice for this, because he's definitely got a unique vision of his own.
I think Rob Zombie's a good filmmaker. Mm-hmm. That's not in question. I certainly think his abilities as a filmmaker are on display in this film.
Right.
There's just a lot of things that just didn't work in its concept. In what it was trying to do.
Right.
It's like, I can praise Rob Zombie's abilities. It doesn't mean I have to like what the results produced.
Right.
A lot of it just didn't work for me in terms of the reimagining of what he wanted to do with it. Mm-hmm. Is it interesting? Yes. Should it have been called Halloween? Absolutely not.
That's the thing.
I think had he just not had to carry the Halloween brand, or if it was the Halloween brand, mm-hmm. but if this was a true Halloween Resurrection, different kid, different name, different situation, different town, mm-hmm. different everything. It's just, we'll start all over again, but it's a new kid in a new town somewhere else. That I would have more appreciated, I think. But because you're coming in with all this baggage of right. the Halloween and the legacy of it all, the film can't help but shortchange a lot of the things that are good and that we like in the original. Mm-hmm. Namely, the character of Laurie and her friends and Dr. Loomis, who are all supporting characters now. And Michael Myers is the lead character.
Hi, I'm Michael Myers.
Okay. I mean, this is the Michael Myers story.
Sure.
As a film. But there's dangers in trying to elicit sympathy from a psychopath.
You remember nothing about getting a knife?
Mm-mm. I didn't do that.
Oh, okay. But you were covered in blood. Whose blood was it?
Mm-hmm. Which is what this movie does.
We're going to try to explain what made Michael Myers Michael Myers. At least that's the intention
right.
that I got of what the filmmakers were trying to do. Mm-hmm. So what is the big switch? Is it that evil gets in him? What makes him suddenly want to kill?
Well, see, I think that's really not what the story is. It's almost not really a story about evil. It's a story about mental illness. I mean, because think about it. The shock all of a sudden is that he's got pictures of, you know, cut up animals. And then he also was killing these animals, you know. And that's the beginning where people start get warning signs of, okay, we've got a problem here. You're starting to see what Zombie wanted to focus on, and he even said so. I got a quote here. Says, Zombie explained that he wanted Michael to be truer to what a psychopath really is and wanted the mask to be a way for Michael to hide. So really his story that he's interested in telling is, here's the growth of a psychopath. And
this is how you create a psychopath.
Well, create a psychopath, but also there could be, you know, biological, you know, brain damage up there that helps cause this.
If you watch Michael outside the principal's office, that's when he has the snap, the change.
Right.
because his mother's in there and she can't believe what's going on. And he just gets up and walks out. Uh-huh. And what's the next thing he does? He beats the shit out of the kid with the stick, right?
Right.
Something has changed in Michael. Uh-huh. Okay? We never find out any of what the trigger was because obviously later on he's back to being a normal, lovable kid again. And then the trigger happens again. When what? His sister doesn't take him trick-or-treating? Right. And I did not like the scene where he's out on the curb and love hurts and his mom is stripping. Is this a movie about a woman who strips? And is the stripping the reason that is Zombie trying to tell me that Michael is so upset over the fact of his mom stripping and the fact that other kids make fun of it? That's what turned him into a killer? That's his trigger?
Ultimately, the worst thing that George Lucas did was try to explain the Force. Remember? With midichlorians and shit? And it was like,
I agree.
It was so much better when he just said, it surrounds us, it penetrates us, it binds the galaxy together. Really, isn't that what Michael Myers is? Can't he just be something that we don't understand, a force, a force of evil, an unrelentless force of rage that is, it's like, is he supernatural? Is he this? I think that's ultimately what makes this movie throw, is that you can either take it or leave it. Okay, here's an interesting story about the origin of a psychopath, and it's sad and it's heartbreaking. And, when he finally gets to be an adult, I always hearken back to the child. And I kind of liked the kid. I thought he played the role well, and he was interesting to me. And I think the film in itself, I watched and I was interested up until it got to the point where it was the remake of Halloween and Haddonfield and all that. And then the movie just went completely off the rails for me. I didn't give a shit. I didn't care. I thought it was terrible. The remake, it's like, it wasn't even necessary. I don't even think Rob Zombie wanted to do that. We didn't need a new Laurie Strode. We didn't need that whole story. So it was just the...
God, no. And he had to shortchange the whole thing.
Right.
I really, this is going to sound really strange to say, but I think Friday the 13th 1 and 2... do a better job of developing their characters than this movie does.
Right.
With Lawyer and her friends. They don't really have any time to do much with those characters.
Well, that's the problem.
God, they're just laughing, giggling, annoying girls, and they're one note.
Right.
And that's it.
The problem is that he's interested in the prequel, not the remake. And so, go ahead and do your prequel and try to make it interesting, but he knows that he has to do the remake to sell tickets. And that's why the remake gets the short change and means nothing.
To me, it just felt so rushed. Like it was just in a hurry to get through it all, like a checklist. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, oh, I got to do this, got to do that, check, check, check. Again, trying to do something interesting, I guess, with Michael letting her go at the end and all that, right?
Right.
Again, eliciting sympathy from a guy that's just been butchering people for the movie. So it's strange when a movie's asking to play with my emotions that way. It's not like he's Hannibal Lecter,
no.
Oozing charisma and great one-liners that, find yourself endeared to him, or like Richard III, or even Alex from Clockwork Orange. Those are kind of characters of villains, bad people, but we get behind them often because of their charismatic features.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to get that. This is just a sympathy case with Michael Myers. And I didn't have the sympathy I think that Rob Zombie wanted me to have.
Right.
I felt like the humanitarian thing to do was to put him down.
Yeah, like
because
a dog.
There,
yeah.
There was, I don't know.
Old Yeller, put him down. Well, and in the version that we saw, they did put him down. But that's not what happened in the theatrical.
See, obviously, he had his approach that he did when he wrote the script and he made a first cut of the movie.
Right.
And then they tested it and they had problems.
Right.
So they went back and re-edited it, amped up the gore, and changed the ending. I mean, what was the theatrical ending? Because I know it was different.
The theatrical ending was Michael kills Loomis. Theatrical ending. Loomis intervenes, but Michael kills him by crushing his skull. Laurie takes Loomis's gun and runs upstairs. She is chased by Michael, who, after cornering her on a balcony, charges her head on and knocks both of them over the railing. Laurie finds herself on top of a bleeding Michael, aiming Loomis's gun at his face. He repeatedly pulls the trigger until the gun finally goes off, just as Michael's hand grips Laurie's wrist. So Laurie kills him.
Yeah.
You get two different things here. And in the alternative version, Michael is killed, Loomis lives, and they play the whole game of we feel sorry for Michael.
Well, see, that's the film Rob Zombie wanted to make.
Right.
The theatrical is a compromised, you know, product. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm willing more to give Rob Zombie the benefit of the doubt of what he was attempting to do. And I applaud him. You know, he made his own movie, and certainly it's a ferocious movie. The way that it's filmed and edited, I mean, it's brutal. I mean, it looks like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre version of Halloween in some ways.
Right.
It doesn't have any of the kind of feel or atmosphere of the first film at all.
I don't think it's a terrible movie, and it's definitely not the worst in the series. I don't know that I love it, but I definitely don't hate it. I'm intrigued by it, to be honest with you. And I might like to watch it again to vibe off of it. I don't think it was necessary. I don't think it was maybe necessarily successful at what he was trying to do. But I applaud Zombie for doing something different. I think the key thing is what you said, is that let's not call this Halloween. Let's call this Birth of a Psycho or something like that. Because you've got so much weight you're having to deal with the Michael Myers story.
Or if you have to call it Halloween, let's just have it be the real curse of Michael Myers that affects a whole new canvas of characters and situations.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So it doesn't have to carry all that kind of baggage, because, I mean, who is this film for? Is it for fans of Halloween 1 through 8? Or is it for people that have never seen Halloween before ever?
Right.
I'm guessing it's the latter.
Okay, let's go ahead and wrap up this show looking over all the Halloween movies, this giant saga that we've looked at 30 years. I mean, come on, 30 years. How did this thing live so long? But
I hear a cash register out there somewhere.
I mean, really, how many films are really good in there? You know, one. One is really good, and the rest are just kind of So, I mean, it's tough to say.
Well, they've been able to keep the Michael Myers brand alive through different merchandising, you know, say through action figures. I mean, when McFarlane did those Movie Maniacs action figures, that was a big deal at the time.
Well, he's a cool image no matter how you look at it. I mean, it's just fascinating to me that there's still a brand for that and that there is such an underground movement. I mean, I go on the internet and look around. You will see big groupings of people who are Halloween fanatics. I mean, they are out there. They have Halloween conventions. I mean, it's amazing, and it's just for this series of films.
I bet you, if you would look at the people that are part of this phenomena, you know, a lot of them were like us. They were struck by the first film, probably at an age when that film was really allowed to work its best.
Right.
And the whole idea of the boogeyman, the shape in Michael Myers, stays with your subconscious. So when a sequel comes out, there's the curiosity factor.
Sure, absolutely.
Ooh, I wonder what happens now, you know? And so you find yourself going, okay, I'm going to give it a try, you know? And regardless of how disappointed you are or whatever, you still keep moving forward with the maybe. Because then you get a surprise, like H2O.
One thing, as we've gone over all these, and, you know, we took pretty extensive notes. I know both of us did. And it's kind of heartbreaking after doing the show to look back on it and say, God, there's so much that we didn't cover. I mean, we were able to touch on some things, but we've got so many things that we, you know, nuggets of information, little things, you know, things like Jamie Lee Curtis was the voice in Halloween 3, you know, the phone operator. The fact that little Jamie grew up and became, she's in the new Halloween movie.
Right, Danielle Harris. Right?
Yeah, and she's even nude in it. It's interesting. There's just so many little tidbits that we didn't even touch on. And look at the length of the show that we made already. I mean, we could probably do this thing this could be like a Bond thing almost, you know? Two-parter, three-parter if we really wanted to go that deep. But, I mean, I'm satisfied with
where we went. Well, I think what's also important is this information is available out there.
Sure.
Most of the people that go to the Internet Movie Database can sort of glean this trivia-type information. You know, hopefully what this show has done is sort of given an overview of the series, sort of reflect on the intentions of the creators and sort of our thoughts of, because we've been with it for 30 years.
Right.
So in a way, we're kind of perfect to do the reflective show of going back and,
you know, trudging our way through each installment. And, of course, we're looking at it with our 2007 eyes.
Right.
As opposed to the eyes of when they originally came out, because I had certainly a lot more fondness for Halloween 2 back then than, say, I did now.
You know, we always play the good and the bad and the ugly.
I think there's another category, though, that a lot of people don't realize. Before Sergio Leone did the final draft of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, there was a fourth character.
Oh, yeah?
And this guy didn't make it, and he's the worst. So it's really The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and the Worst.
The Worst, yes. I'm down with that. I like that. I like that.
And the Worst is for that really special thing.
Yeah, the stinker.
I mean, it makes the ugly like a guy you want to have over, you know, for a beer, you know? You want to stay so far away from the worst as you can.
All right, you ready? Let's shotgun it. Good. Halloween 1. Duh.
Beginning to end. And I'm not even going to say the extended cut. I think the theatrical cut completely works on its own.
Right.
I don't feel like it needs the enhanced sister subplot and the extra, you know, Loomis scenes. If you really watch them, while they're interesting, they really drag because they're all just shoe leather.
The bad Halloween 4.
Yeah.
It was bad, man. It was a stinker. Close in line was Halloween 5, but
Halloween 5 is kind of boring, but I'll give it some style points because at least visually it's a little bit more interesting.
Right. It's really a toss-up between 4 and 5 then, but I got to go 4.
And I really didn't like Part 2 because of the stupid plot holes in it.
Right.
And the dumb things like cars coming out of nowhere and hitting guys and just all the creative, you know, scolding hot kills. I mean, if I talk about Halloween 2 long enough, it might be the worst.
The ugly. Now, let's define what ugly means. It's not terrible. It just means separated, maybe.
If you go into Sergio terms, that you can find yourself endeared to Tuco, even
right.
though he's a bastard, right?
Sure, absolutely.
And also, ugly could be guilty pleasure, for that matter,
right?
Screw you. I don't care if you think my wife is ugly. I love her, right? I mean, Halloween 3 certainly qualifies as the guilty pleasure, and it is the true ugly one out of all of them, because it's brutal
right.
in terms of its plot and its, you know, diabolical intentions on Halloween. I mean, it's far more scarier than the Boogeyman
yeah.
in terms of its threat. So there is something ugly about Halloween 3's intention and the fact that it is the apocalypse-type ending to where, you know, we're fucked.
The Worst! Michael Myers is like a killer shark. Halloween Resurrection.
It is Resurrection. It was supposed to be the Homecoming, I think.
Okay.
But they wanted people to think that Michael Myers was in it, so there had to be Resurrection.
Well, here's what I'll tell
which
you.
Which I think would have been a better title for Rob Zombie's movie. And like I think we were saying, just have it be new characters.
Right.
And call it Halloween Resurrection. But
right.
We're in the heart of remake fever. And unfortunately, you can't call the remake the worst because at least the filmmaker is interested in the film he's making. He doesn't feel like he's making an assembly line movie,
right.
A hacked out, you know, just remake for cash, like probably The Fog or The Assault
right.
on Precinct 13 filmmakers that were thinking. But on the other hand, I think he might have overthought what he was doing at the same time.
Yeah, I definitely do not hate Zombies remake. I think it's much better than 4 and 5, definitely than Resurrection. Visually, it's interesting, and I think it's interesting, like we said during that section, apart from Halloween, it's something. It could be something completely different. So I definitely don't
well, I mean,
hate
I
it.
I think he had the chops. There's a brutal ferociousness to the way Michael attacks the prey. I mean, you know,
right.
Daniel Harris is naked, and, you know, the way he shoots it, it's very different. It feels real
mm-hmm.
in a way, like it's happening. So there's an edge to it. But unfortunately, when everything else around it is so shallow, when I don't
right.
even really know these characters or care about them and whatnot, it's, I don't know, maybe it's an awkward feeling.
Here we go. Three favorite moments in the Halloween series. You can come up with them real quick. I'll give you mine real quick. the ending of number one, the ending of number three.
Stop it!
And the ending of H2O with the head chop.
Yeah, those are all good. I like, of course, when Shape gets the guy in the kitchen. In the first Halloween. The sheet with the glasses was always really good.
Yeah.
As an image, was kind of creepy. Mm-hmm. Judith Myers on the bed was a striking image. Or not Judith Myers, but her headstone.
Right.
And the dead teenager. I always found that to be a striking image. The tension of when Laurie's running up to that door and the Shape's coming, and it's just, you know, the cutting of that was always really good moment, I think, in the series. Mm-hmm. In H2O, I like the way he, like, lifts himself down really slowly with one hand. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Kind of behind her. That was kind of interesting.
Oh, and I definitely would say in H2O, when they go face-to-face through the window, love that.
Yeah,
love
yeah.
that.
Yeah, that's really good, too.
That's fantastic. Here's the big question now. Does the series continue? What happens next? Are we finished?
Well, what do the Weinsteins say?
Okay, well, I got a quote here. And this is straight from the Weinsteins. They say, despite the film's opening weekend success, Bob Weinstein told Reuters that he doubts there will be another Halloween film, stating, I never say never, but it would have to be something very, very different.
So they're talking, what, Michael in space different?
Well, what does Malik say? If the contract will eventually run out and Malik will take it to somewhere else, you know.
Right,
as they've done before. So I'd listen to Malik before I'd listen to Harvey or Bob.
Malik's going to make sure he lives forever, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, you know what? It wouldn't surprise me to see Michael jump into this versus thing. But that's a way to reinvent the series and keep it fresh, I guess.
Do you like that, the versus thing?
I mean, it's kind of fun in a geeky way. Let's get Michael and Jason and Freddy, and let's get them all on one big thing and have some sort of an interesting plot to where they really have some, you know, cool fights. So
I think that's really easier said than done.
Absolutely. All right, so there you go. That's our first annual Halloween show. I don't know, do you want to do this again next year? So what, you're saying Jason next year, right?
I'm saying nothing.
Well, so we could go Jason, we could go Freddy. All right, who else we got? Pinhead, Leatherface? You want to go Chucky? Come on, let's do Chucky.
Oh, they're remaking Chucky, too.
Oh, great.
Oh, they're remaking them all. Yeah, these series are going to find themselves in a knot.
Yeah.
Because they're going to remake Nightmare before you know it.
Sure.
They're already talking the Hellraiser remake.
Uh-huh.
They've already remade Texas and did the prequel. You know? I mean, it's they are going to be finding, where do they go from here?
Right.
I mean, are they really sewing up for good these franchises? Or do we just reinvent them again, all over again, you know, 5-10 years from now? Is it just another remake to reboot all over again?
Right. Well, here's one I know that we can both agree on, so let's just agree on it now. Next year, we're going to do Piranhas.
Oh, I love to do Piranha. In and out, two films, boom.
Boom. Piranhas it is. All right, next Halloween, Piranhas. Get ready. So, tell you what, why don't you come on by our website at www.hollywoodsaloon.com. If you want to get in touch with us, it's hollywoodsaloon@yahoo.com. Look, we know we've kept you here a long, long, long time. But
you know there's a reason for that.
There's a reason, because we're giving away stuff. We're doing some haunted Halloween swag. That's right, Halloween swag. And you know what? We brought on a brand new partner to do it with.
The night our partner came home.
At our Saloon Swag page, www.hollywoodsaloon.com/contests.html, or you can get there from the main page of the Hollywood Saloon, you will see what we're offering. And we've just made a connection with a website called wickedcoolstuff.com. Now, I'm telling you, it's one of the coolest sites out there for movie fan just...
Well, if the name of the website didn't say it all...
It does, you know, right there.
I might have to say something, but I can't say it better than the name of the website.
Wicked Cool Stuff. It's got all the movie stuff. I mean, t-shirts, action figures, statues. They got bobbleheads. They got lunch kits. I mean, they got the coolest damn stuff all connected with movies and media and TV that you could ever want. I mean, I've looked at them for a long time, and you know, we made that connection, and they're giving us a couple things to give away to you... from Halloween, an official Halloween mask. I mean, this is like an expensive thing. This is not like a throwaway thing here. This is like a $50 mask.
And I can go on record saying this mask is better than the mask used in Halloween 4, 5, and 6.
I would hope so.
It is a better mask.
Yeah.
So you know that you have something better than that was in the actual films.
Exactly. So
if you call them that.
So Wicked Cool Stuff is giving away a mask, and they're also giving away one Halloween action figure. It looks awesome. I want it myself. So come on by, check that out. And us, the Hollywood Saloon, is giving you two copies of Halloween on DVD and also a documentary called Halloween, what was it called? Halloween the 25 Years or something.
Yeah, it's a 25-year celebration.
Right.
It's got a lot of interviews with a lot of people involved in the series.
Right, it's all back stuff. It's a great disc. You're going to want
it. Clips from the Halloween convention you were talking about.
Exactly. So, it's very interesting if you're a Halloween fan. So come on by the site, Saloon Swag. We'll put a deadline up there so you can see when it'll all come to an end. We'll give you at least a week from Halloween when we put this out. But come on by. Go to wickedcoolstuff.com. It is a badass site, and there's badass stuff waiting there for you to pick up. I know I'm going to be buying some stuff from there. They've got some really good specials going on. So check them out. And so there we go. Hollywood Saloon, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.